Welcome back, Martini Giant fans. This is episode number 138, which is Raising Arizona from 1987, directed, of course, by the Coen brothers. Now, there's a very specific reason that we're picking this episode to talk about today. And the reason being is that one of the people involved in the making of this episode as part of the camera crew back then is Richard Crudo. And Richard Crudo is an incredible person. He's been president of the ASC six times. But why is he important? Well, because Martini Giant, as a group, is actually working on a production with him. We're doing a short, and it's very exciting. And I finally am able to talk about it just a little bit because it's an article that came out in Variety about the project we're involved with. Yes, this is part of Chaos as well, which is the company that I actually work for, and part of the Innovation Lab. We've been developing something called Project Arena, which involves real-time ray tracing and virtual production. And yes, Martini Giant is involved in one of the proof-of-concept shorts that we're doing, and it's really exciting to be able to talk about that. So we said, oh, we'll talk about a movie that Richard worked on because it's really cool. And of course, Raising Arizona is a great movie. We love this movie. It's an amazing thing. And the camera work in this film is incredible. And it's just sort of really cool to think of Richard being involved in that making of that movie. So very exciting to see that as well. In terms of our schedule or announcements, not many things I can tell you much more, except that we are going to record a podcast. For those of you who are Martini Giant fans, you guys know that on Saturdays at 3 p.m., usually Pacific Standard Time, we usually broadcast our podcast before they go as actual podcasts. So if you want to watch it live, you can. It's on Twitch, which is twitch.tv/martini_giant. twitch.tv/martini_giant. We also go on YouTube Live, and YouTube, our YouTube is youtube.com/@martinigiant, youtube.com/@martinigiant. And we may actually talk about this project on this next Saturday. So if you want to check us out, definitely come by and do that, which will be, I guess, April 6th. So April 6th, 3 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. We'd love to hear from you. And if you have questions, you can, of course, just go on chat and ask questions away. There's only certain things we can talk about or not talk about, but we're very excited to sort of start talking about all the processes of making us these things here. So very, very cool. Okay, but for now, please enjoy episode number 138, Raising Arizona. So, Raising yes. Arizona is the movie of choice. There's reasons we chose this movie. One is it's a great movie. We've had it on our list for a while. I want to talk about Raising Arizona for like a while, as I said. But the problem, not the problem, the thing that inspired us is that we've been working on a project recently together, and one of the people we've been working with happened to be one of the camera operators on Raising Arizona.
Yeah, it's very exciting.
Very, very exciting.
Very talented DP.
Nice. Yeah, very nice guy.
And and the camera work in this film is so
it's
funny.
Crazy. Yeah, it's crazy. This is like half the movie. Like, it's a great script and a great cast, but the photography is absolute comic genius.
The cinematographer is most of the joke.
Yeah.
Like the really angles of the cameras, the movement of the camera.
Yeah. Did you hear that it was influenced by Evil Dead?
Oh, it was? Absolutely. Yeah, because they're very tight friends with Sam Raimi. They've made movies with Sam Raimi before. Crime Wave, stuff like that.
And researching for this show, I found that out. Mm-hmm. And the guy that they wanted to cast, you guys probably read that?
No.
Oh, what's his name?
Kevin Costner.
Kevin Costner?
That's the wrong choice.
He
went three times for an audition.
He would have been, if I didn't know about how good Nicolas Cage was, Kevin Costner is actually pretty good.
Know who for Ed?
Who?
Who went back a couple times, but she didn't get it, was, so they say, Kate Capshaw.
Oh, yeah. Like, that's the sort of B-plus, mid-80s Spielberg version of that movie. And it's pretty good. But it is no Nicolas Cage, Holly Hunter, which is an all-timer, like, thin man combination. Like, it's unbelievable, the teamwork they have in this movie. That's
when did you guys, I'm not trying to show my age in any which way, but I remember seeing this in the theater and I was blown away.
Yeah.
When did it come out?
84? 88? 88.
Yeah.
I might have been in
theaters. I saw it in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, I saw
it. I might have seen it in theaters.
Yeah. I was like, I can't believe how refreshing this movie is. I was like blown away.
I didn't know anything about these guys.
Yeah. And I also was like, that was the same year of Beetlejuice. I was like so excited for filmmaking because there was this visual quality to it that was also just great stories and so quirky. And, you know, it's just, it was exciting. It was an exciting time for film. And of course, it was crushed, but still.
That, like, the late 80s, early 90s for indie film is the reason I think about film the way that I do. I think that it's really a legendary period of time. There's like, after that, indie film becomes very popular via like Pulp Fiction. And then it becomes a whole different level of it. Like, or rather, through Sex, Lies, and Videotape. Like, that becomes a whole different level of an event.
Yeah.
But indie film in the 80s and 80s and early 90s, before it became like culturally relevant, is some of the most wild, experimental, crazy stuff that has ever been done in America.
I got to say, watching this again, this was so... I see Tarantino was influenced by this.
Oh, huge, yeah. Yeah, I believe he's a giant fan of this movie in particular. Like,
yeah, there was something about, like, even just the whole, all the little routines and the way it was shot. I was like, God, I didn't put the two and two together.
Yeah, it's a very tight comic screenplay. You know, it's like there's not any extra bits in this movie. Like, I feel like when you watch comedy today, so many comedies are just like padded out to the nth degree. They're just like, oh, just let these funny people riff and
let them breathe.
And I'm just like, oh my God. Like, it's not like I don't like Kate McKinnon, but you don't have to fucking work out your bit in front of the camera.
Okay, like, so are you talking about Barbie?
And other things, but yeah,
I felt that way about her with Barbie, like Kate McKinnon.
Yeah,
I like
Kate McKinnon a lot, but like, you know, don't just hire her and then go, okay, be funny, we're rolling. Like, that's not how you make a movie. Like, that is how you make a movie, but you have to be really focused if you're making that kind of movie. Like, improv is a different thing entirely.
So speaking to Richard, we should talk about the guy we're talking about who this film is, Richard Crudo.
Richard Crudo.
Really nice guy, great DP. He was also... he was also the head of the ASC for several years.
Yep.
But I did a podcast with him, which is going to come out on CG Garage, which I'm very excited about. And he was mentioning how, like, you know, he worked with Gordon Willis quite a bit, which of course we all just
gushed over.
A hero
of Martini Giant, absolutely. Yes. Yeah.
But he mentioned how they would plan out shots all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
They blocked them out. They worked it out. They go boom. And you see this film, and this film was planned out.
Yeah.
Every shot.
They know
what
the gag is. Yeah,
they
exactly.
They plan. And he goes, this was great. Eric, you're going to like it. He likened it like it used to be a heist where we would plan every single step.
Yeah, it's a great
idea.
Now
it's a smash and grab. Shoot everything.
Yeah, which is, you know, like, the thing is, like, you can make a good movie that way. There are plenty of movies that are made that way. But, like, if you're doing a comedy in particular, the more you think through how it's going to work, the better your chances of ending up with great footage that you can make something funny out of. And, like, you don't want to go into a comedy and sort of randomly get coverage. Like, that, like... You're not doing the movie any favors. Like the camera
is joke is.
Yeah, exactly. Like the staging of comedy in particular, like even more so than like horror, is absolutely paramount to making jokes work. And and if you don't, if you're just like grabbing stuff and going like A B, okay, just intercut it and it's going to work, then you're losing a channel of information by which you can make people like laugh and. Mm-hmm. And so, like, the great comedies to me, like Raising Arizona and Tootsie and all this kind of stuff, like, these are flawlessly staged movies. Right. Like, they're beautifully blocked. All the photography is, like, really, really thought through and framed to maximize the interaction between layers of characters. Not just going, okay, Kate, tell a joke. Right. You know? And then she tells six jokes and you take the top five.
Right.
Yeah. Like that's just not,
that's one way of doing it.
Yeah. It's
smash and grab.
Smash and grab. Smash and grab. But that's, I love Richard's thing of it being a heist. Yeah, exactly.
Like it used to be a heist. Like you planned every freaking step and you got there and that's how you did it. By the way, my first, my initial review of non-alcoholic Blue Moon pretty much just tastes like orange soda. It doesn't have much beer taste to it whatsoever.
Well, that's the thing is like what really works with the...
But the other ones, like Athletic, still tastes like beer to me.
Yeah, Athletic, because Athletic leverages the things that you only get out of beer. Like the like it has flavors that you really only get in beer. But like orange is not a novel flavor for beer.
But that's because Blue Moon is traditionally served with an orange in it, right?
Yes, so, exactly. I get it. I get it. But that's Yeah, that's plain soda. If you want, I mean, I'm having myself a Spindrift.
Which one is this? This is the
mango peach, I think.
Ooh,
Mango orange, and it's
sweet.
Yeah, it's not very, well. That's a great thing.
Of course, it's Spindrift. It's not too sweet.
Right? It's actually pretty tart, right? And it tastes more like I'm having an alcoholic drink than if I were drinking a Blue Moon.
Yeah, this tastes like Orangina with a.
Oh, I love Orangina.
It does. Well,
but buy Orangina. It's cheaper.
Buy Orangina. It's probably cheaper. Yeah.
Well,
I do like Orangina too.
Before we talk about Raising Arizona, to set the stage, what are
you already jumped into?
Yeah, here it is. No, but what are your top comedies when you think of well-shot comedies?
Oh, this is up there. This is one of the best shot comedies out there.
Top five for sure.
Really well-shot comedies.
Young Frankenstein.
Yeah.
Broadway Danny Rose.
Broadway Danny Rose. Great call. Yes.
Yeah.
Great
also call. Involved Richard Crudo.
Yeah, that's true. Another Crudo project.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's a big one.
What are the really well shot comedies? I'm trying to think.
Because
anything with like some like a hot type of comedy.
Anything by what's his name? Who's the guy Hot Billy Wilder. Wilder. Like you get one,
Benny
two, three,
Wilder.
Or
yeah, the apartment,
Wilder,
right?
The apartment, yeah. Oh, the apartment. That might be one or two.
Yeah,
like that is a perfectly shot movie. Yeah. Jesus, that's a good. That's
but
a,
this the execution. I was thinking about this film because obviously we have to do it. The podcast. I always like to watch it. Now, when you watch the podcast, you have a new frame. You try to put a new frame of mind. This movie is like a fairy tale.
It feels
very much like a fairy tale.
Mm-hmm. They're using a lot of shorter lenses, which makes things look a little bit more surreal.
Right.
Right. Everything's a little bit more bowed out, especially when there's camera motion. There's lots of visual traveling.
Right.
You know, like when they're doing the chase sequence with the dogs, like everything looks like it's going 400 miles an hour.
Yeah, by the way, lot of Barry was used. Barry sourced some of this stuff. Because I watched some of this, I was like, oh my God, there was these Barry gags with the cars coming out of the back of the supermarket.
Yeah.
Right? And that whole suit is like the supermarket fight in Barry.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Anything
where
a car comes to a sudden stop shot on a very wide angle lens.
Yeah, exactly. Then you're in that territory.
The dog.
And Barry Sonnenfeld, who is the director of photography on this show, like he has a very sort of like, similar style throughout all of his Coen Brothers work. His best stuff is like Raising Arizona, which is his like radical comic style, and Miller's Crossing, which is comparatively very, very reserved. But Miller's Crossing, even though it's not a comedy, is still shot like a comedy. Like there's lots of tension in these frames. As you're waiting for the other
shoot.
Did you
do Lebowski?
I think Lebowski was... I think that was Deakins. Let me see.
Yeah, I think it was.
Who shot the Big Lebowski?
I actually think that the Lebowski, the Big Lebowski cinematography is fabulous, but I actually think Raising Arizona is more compelling.
Right, it's more Raising Arizona is more participatory.
Yes.
You know, like Lebowski is great, but it gives a lot of it just gives a big proscenium for funny things to happen.
That's what it does.
It's very funny, but it's
background.
Right back. Yeah, it's background. Yeah.
This one's in your face hilarious.
Yeah, this one's really like
when you see especially all the POV stuff of the baby, like from the low angle cameras or the bouncing camera as the baby's.
Yeah, because this is also when you talk about Evil Dead, like Evil Dead is very much shot the same way. You know, it's like this, you know, the camera, like Evil Dead.
Did you shoot like Evil Dead?
They just referenced it.
Let's see. Let's see. Director of photography. Evil Dead. Because Raimi directed Evil Dead. It doesn't even list it. Where is it? They must have had a director of photography. Evil Dead 2. You know, 1 second. But yeah, like it. Evil Dead 2 has one of my favorite. It has the evil cam, right? And like it's a point of view, very short lens camera that's chasing around after the good guy. And it's hysterically
funny. Can you imagine
just
shooting that where you're just a cameraman running around after people?
It's so good. Yeah. It's so good. And like that, because I mean, there are plenty of movies that do that gag, but like they give such a personality to it. Like it'll be chasing after Bruce Campbell and he's chasing through the house. And usually it's a spiritual thing that's chasing him. So like when Bruce Campbell runs into a room and hides and the camera follows in after him and the camera doesn't find Bruce Campbell. And the camera looks around, confused. You're like, wait, the ghost is confused? It's super, super funny. Okay, let's see. Writing. Peter Deming was the DP. Uh-huh. Who also shot Mulholland Drive.
Wow.
That's weird. But yeah, so that's a very shared flavor. The Coens and Sam Raimi cross... You know, they're very, very Venn diagram in their comedy. Yeah, Sam Raimi goes way far over the line, and the Coens are just a little more reserved. But it's the same style, for sure.
But they do comedy really well.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
So this is the thing that I think is so awesome about the Coen brothers. They act, if you look at the, like, Raising Arizona and No Country for Old Men, like, you know,
yeah,
I mean, it's almost a similar film.
Yeah, it is, and the thing is, No Country is also very funny. Like, I don't think anyone would call it a comedy, but it's
thing,
like it's
no
a very wry,
a
wry jokes.
Yes, no one's
but like there is lots of very funny shit in that movie. It's just funny in the context of being essentially a horror movie.
Yeah, right. There is a lot of funny stuff in that movie, particularly from Jeff Bridges.
Yeah, there's so many, their next
on a roof is going to fall in. There's like, some commentary he always has.
And, right. Well, it's like their next movie is a straight up horror film. And I think that
they were not going to do movies. They got back together.
They just announced they're going to come back and do one more film. They took they were on a good break. But now they want to return to business and, they have a horror film idea. And they've never done an absolutely straightforward horror film, but I think they're going to do it great because horror and comedy are very deeply interlinked in how they work on the audience.
You know, it's a scary movie.
Yeah, exactly. And this is why it crosses over so well. I mean, you can have something that's absolutely stone cold scary, no jokes.
Sure.
But the way that you shoot the stuff with set up and payoff and staging within the same frame is very much the same. You know, and how you build the comic tension is how you also build the scary tension as well. So when you see like No Country for Old Men, when, you know, like he leaps out the window and runs to the guy in the truck, right? And it's just like, you just keep driving. And he talks to the guy for like 3 seconds. And the guy's about to go.
His jaw
like,
is shut off.
Dude, that's my favorite. Explodes.
I know. It's my favorite part of that movie.
It's
so,
so
funny. It's just like, what?
Yeah. You know, like it's shocking and it's horrifying.
Just like
but
the death
so
of that
ridiculous.
Guy, Smalls, the way he blows up is just awesome.
Yeah. It's just hysterical. So let's talk about what the plot of Raising Arizona is. How about that? Let's go.
But we can. The first 11 minutes is the entire first act of the film.
Yeah.
Done in the most compressed and efficient way possible and hilarious.
And pre-titles.
Yeah.
The best thing about this is the first act ends in the titles of the film.
Well, that's the call to action, right?
Yes.
It's like, okay, here's the premise of the film is they're going to kidnap
the
a baby.
Same 11th pain. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And it takes them 11 minutes to understand why they're going to kidnap a baby.
And they pack so much information in there.
Into that 11 minute. And it's like, no one has ever done anything like that.
Yeah.
Right.
It's just
if you read the freaking Save the Cat book, right? Mm-hmm. They say, don't do that. They're like, it has to be 20 minutes, right?
Yeah.
But they did it in the 11th. The page 11 or the 11th minute is the first part of Save the Cat.
Yeah, that's when page 11 is when you're done with the introduction of everything.
Yeah.
Right. But they are right in like the moment after the titles fade is when they're in the stealing the baby event.
Right.
Which is like that means they've already made the decision. They've already that is definitely a turning point of act one, like immediately. Once they steal the kid, the movie's off to the races and you're only 11 minutes in the movie and it gives them all this room to make it as complicated and ridiculous as they possibly want it to.
And it's complicated. You listen to that 11 minutes. What's brilliant about it is there's a lot of stuff that happens in that 11 minutes mm-hmm. and it's all done with comedy and everything.
Oh, they pack it in there, man. You get all of H.I.'s backstory. Mm-hmm. Right, you get you introduce sure. all the elements that you need.
Right.
Holly Hunter is a cop. You see that the fiance left her.
She starts to feel sorry for him and love him.
Right,
he's a repeat offender.
Repeat offender. Oh my god! I guess I am telling you what you want to hear.
He is a small time grocery store or convenience store thief.
Right, yeah, he's the hold up guy,
right? And he gets busted every time. He gets completely goes back to jail multiple times. Every time he goes to jail,
he goes through the same processing every single time.
Where they take his photographs, turn to the right, turn to the left. And right, that's Holly Hunter who takes his picture.
Yeah, sees her every single time,
and he says she's a fine lady.
Yeah, my finance left me. And so develops their love story over the course of 10 minutes and gets them married. And then they find out that they can't have kids.
Well, you also find out that he's just cannot stop robbing convenience stores. These two characters behind Eric, which is, John Goodman. And I don't know who the other guy is. I
forgot. Oh, he's great. What's his name? William something. I'll look that up for you. But yeah, so they get brought in. It's terrific characters.
I also love the fact that you were introduced to those characters when they are in therapy together, group therapy together.
Oh my god, it's so good.
And they do horrible things like robbing banks and everything else, and they interpret it as, this is what I was told to do in therapy.
Yes, exactly. This is all part of my journey.
It's all part of my journey. You know, I mean, Dr. So-and-so told me that I got to take, some initiative in my life. So this is me taking initiative by robbing this bank.
And so, yeah, William Forsythe is the other guy.
Some people put career before family.
Yeah, it's so good. And the thing is, this is basically a growing up movie about H.I. Like, H.I. doesn't want to grow up. He loves fucking around with his buddies, and that's what he wants. He doesn't want to.
But he is completely in love with her.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So this is the kind of thing that you make. It's like when David Lynch made Eraserhead because his wife was pregnant and he was terrified of becoming a dad. Right. And so the entirety of Eraserhead is the anxiety about becoming a dad. And this is basically the same thing. I'm sure that it's Joel or Ethan was just like, oh shit, I'm married now and my life is changing and I don't really want to stop doing all the fun stuff, but I love my wife and I want to have the best of both worlds, for the first couple of years of your marriage, and it's not gonna work out. Like, your life is changing and you have to accept this. And so John Goodman and William Forsythe represent his younger self.
His nostalgia for
his juvenile years.
Yeah.
And he slowly comes to understand that you must leave that past behind.
They are so charming too. It's
so fun. John Goodman, man, he was not even, I don't know if he was fully John Goodman yet.
No,
he'd been
in
a few movies. This is the first time I ever saw him in full bloom. And he is unbelievably funny in this.
Yes. So 88, this came out. Yeah.
Yeah.
A few years after, like Revenge of the Nerds and stuff like that. He's good.
That's right.
So this is after Rosando.
No, before.
Yeah, is it? Before. Yeah. He's in
the 90s.
Yeah, he's like a that guy kind of actor, right?
Yeah.
Where he's good, and you go, I think I've seen him before in other stuff, but this is the first one that I saw him in where I was like, who the fuck is this guy?
This guy's brilliant. Yeah.
Comic genius. You know, and especially bouncing off of Devane, who usually plays like, his partner usually plays like evil, crazy people.
Yeah. Right? I remember this, him in this, and I loved him. And then it was really until we saw the, Barton Fink.
Yeah, that seals the deal as far as Goodman is concerned.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's when you're like, this fucker can act. He's funny and he can act.
Well, Lebowski, too.
Oh, he was also in, you know what else he was in is Sea of Love.
Oh, is he in Sea of Love?
Yeah, with Pacino.
Oh, Pacino, and Barkin. Yeah.
1991.
I really loved that movie when it came out.
So do I. Yeah.
And I have not seen it since. Is it still good?
It holds up. Yeah, it's good.
That's a great thriller. It was a really great thriller. And Pacino with some crazy hair in that movie, but that's a good picture. I don't remember Goodman being in that. That's wild. Yeah, I really have to check that out again.
He's the sidekick for him. He's assigned him. And he's kind of like the sports guy and drinking beer and having fun. But yeah, he's really good in it. He's young.
That's funny. Wow. Yeah, Goodman really has.
You're right. Like, he wasn't in that much. He did Revenge of the Nerds in 84. Mm-hmm. He did Chud.
Yeah, Chud. Chud.
Yeah, the Big Easy.
We did that as
he was in True Stories. I loved him in True Stories.
Yep, he's great in True Stories, which I only just recently saw.
But that was 1986. So 87 was Raising Arizona.
Yeah.
So that might have been one of the influences that got him onto that was his performance on True Stories because that was pretty good. And then Equalizer,
which is also because
he was on Moonlighting. Interesting.
Coen brothers are from the Midwest, but they were shooting Blood Simple in Texas, and Raising Arizona is Texas based as well, isn't it? I think.
Raising Arizona,
it's Phoenix,
in Arizona.
It's Phoenix.
No, it was in Phoenix because they were
Southwestern, right? And so,
Scottsdale, Arizona.
It's different. Yeah. Like Arizona is very different from Texas. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
They were pissed. I think why?
Because they didn't feel like it represented Scottsdale in the proper way. The mayor did, at least.
Okay.
It's amazing how like this. It's one of those moments where like the movie's title is so much a title to me that I don't even recognize what it is. of course, it's shot in Arizona, Dan. It's Raising Arizona. But Raising Arizona is like Star Wars in my mind. Is like this just means this movie and comedy, right? But yeah, like I'm sure they were part of like the Southwestern filmmaking network that True Stories was also a part of.
Sure, but they did have a thing about the Southwest, right?
Yep.
Texas was one of them. That's about as far east as they went, right?
Right. Because they go back for they do Blood Simple, they do No Country is there. No Country was shot at the same time.
But No Country was more that was more West Texas.
Texas, yeah. That's true. Because that's actually good. It was shot. No Country, I think, was shot. I think it was shot in near. What's the place? With
no,
the
it's
lights?
Where they shot
Marfa
Giant.
Lights.
I think it's in Marfa.
It's Marfa where they shot Giant because they were also shooting There Will Be Blood.
Right.
And apparently there was a problem because every time There Would Be Blood would shoot, the gas fires, it would get in the shots for No Country.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It's funny. I think these two absolute titanic movies.
So they had to sync everything because those dark gaseous flames would be on the horizon when they were shooting behind the characters.
Yeah, that's insane. Two absolute classic movies being shot 5 miles apart.
Yeah.
In the same place, in the same time.
That's incredible.
Yeah. And there's silence.
But you find out they fall in love with each other. He gets out of jail. They do get married. They decide that they'd live in a small trailer in the middle of the desert, which looks like a meth house. Mobile home in the desert.
Yeah.
They say the world is too beautiful not to be alone. I mean, his narrative was so. So the writing is so good in this too.
Oh, it's an incredibly tight, funny script.
Very good script.
Yeah, everything that is introduced is used multiple times. Right. You know, like everything pushes everything else around. So you have like
how did it? When they say like she can't have a baby, the way they said it is like we found out that her insides were a rocky place where my seed could find no purchase.
Which is perfect. But it's just like the fact that she's a cop and he's a criminal is great tension, right?
Sure.
Right, which is terrific tension. Mm-hmm. The fact that his, like, you bring in John Goodman and William Devane pulling on High, right? Mm-hmm. You have High's boss and his family coming into the mix and threatening them as well.
Who's the guy who talks to High while he's at the press the whole time?
What's his name? From Blade Runner.
Yes, and he's also in Blood Simple.
Walsh. Emmett Walsh.
Emmett Walsh, yeah.
So good. Oh my God, what a cameo.
That's Bill Carson, you see.
My favorite line, it slipped by me the first 20 times I saw this. He goes, me and my friend were doing a highway emergency work. Not official, you understand, right? So it's just like, you think that he's telling a story about being an EMT.
No,
he's not. Like, they're just patrolling. They're just driving back and forth on the highway looking for car crashes. There's a spherical object arrested in the highway, and it's not a part of the car.
Which is Marfa Lights.
It's so good. So good. Yeah, no. if you're adding Emmett Walsh, like, you're making a good movie, almost certainly.
Yeah,
but yeah, like, great character actors abound in this thing. But like you know, you have so many, like, HI is being pulled in every single direction by this incredible cast of supporting characters, and like, his boss is fucking hysterical. His boss's wife is Frances McDormand. And she's
an angel straight from heaven.
Oh my God. Her work with Holly Hunter is just ridiculous. Like, everything, like,
taking care of this little angel.
We gotta do that, honey. Yeah. Gotta get the dip tent, you know, like all this stuff. And then you got, the dad of the original, of the baby, and he's running his own basic comedy.
Oh, Arizona.
Nathan Arizona.
Yeah.
And so you have like every single element of this mechanism is both a funny movie in its own right, and everything is putting pressure on H.I. McDonough. And so like it's as tight as it can possibly be.
He goes through all this bad part of his life, falls in love with this woman. This is all in 11 minutes. Falls in love with this woman.
Right.
This, you know, they get married. Then they have the salad days of their life, which is so hilarious.
Yeah, the salad days. A Shakespeare quote for you right there. That's pretty great.
And she wants a baby. They can't have a baby. So they don't know what to do. And somehow the news comes on that Nathan Arizona, who owns
Unpainted Arizona. Unpainted Arizona. If you can find lower prices anywhere, my name ain't Nathan Arizona. And of course, his name is not Nathan Arizona. His name is Nathan Huffines.
Why did you change your name to Nathan Huffines? Would you buy furniture from Unpainted Huffines?
Unbelievable.
Now, what's funny is that there is a place in Houston, Texas, mm-hmm. called Gallery Furniture, and it's almost identical.
That's terrific.
To that. And there's a guy, I forgot his name, he's Mr. Gallery Furniture Guy.
Right.
And he is just, I would say like Nathan Arizona is classier than the guy in Houston. Let's just put it that way.
But it's the same shtick.
Same shtick.
Right.
He's like, come on down to Gallery Furniture where we save you money. And he holds up like a wad of cash as he does this, right? And he does this every time. Now, that guy specifically, it's huge, huge stores. They're like money stores, but he's got like the big stores, et cetera. He's very rich in Houston and kind of like this, you know, everyone knows him. Whenever there's like a big flood or something like that, he's always like giving away free mattresses, letting people sleep in his store. Like he's one of the big philanthropists. But what's funny is that he lives in like the Beverly Hills of Houston, and he's not, shall we say, upper crust. So
yeah, oh yeah.
So that's like the conflict. Yeah. They're like, oh well, he's like next door, and you know, drives a big old pickup truck, and probably has a bunch.
That makes
of,
me like him more.
Yeah, that's, probably that's has a bunch of jet skis like parked in the front lawn.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Oh yeah, exactly. Oh, God bless. That's good.
ATVs. Yeah.
I hope unpainted Huff hands isn't going to be at the restaurant tonight.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's good.
Anyway, yeah, like so they so unpainted Huff hands ends up having, it's all over the news, they have five kids. They have quintuplets, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
the Arizona Quints.
Arizona Quints. And that's when Holly Hunter's character, Ed. I love the fact that her name's Ed. Ed and H-I. And they call him Hi.
Yeah, it's so good. Like,
what's his actual name? Herbert?
Oh, I can't. Herbert. Yeah, I think that's it.
Yeah. Because that's, we only find that out because he writes the letter, right?
Yeah.
And he's a fabulous, like, he's so eloquent in the way he says things.
It's amazing. It's great. And this is Nicolas Cage at his absolute prime. Like, I love Nicolas Cage. Moonlight, I think he's wonderful. This is like
Moonstruck and this.
It's like,
this one's
absolute force of nature.
This is even better than Moonstruck because in Moonstruck, he's over the top. And it's kind of jarring.
It's very funny. I think it's very funny.
It's funny, but it doesn't matter. Here, he is over the top and everyone's joining him for the ride.
Yeah, everyone's like, Moonstruck is funny because he's completely out of place. Like, he has his hand, he has his bride, you know, like this completely over the top stuff. And it's good in a cartoony way, and it's funny that it's out of place.
Well, it's disarming, which is why she falls in love with him, right?
Right. But like the greatness of Raising Arizona is, like, as you're saying, is that everybody is supporting this performance. Like, just
everyone's
like,
surreal.
Everyone's aiming at the same target. And so it allows it to become even bigger and broader and sillier because this is the world. The world is a silly place.
Everyone has an over the top character that's completely unique from the other over the top character.
Yeah.
Right. Holly Hunter is just this emotional basket case.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, very she's funny. Like, yeah. Cause she's like, she's getting her, you know, her baby clock is ticking and she's like, she is like keyed in. Like, this is, we need a baby high. They got
you don't come back and
hang out,
baby.
And the thing is, like,
all of their Southern accents are also over the top.
Over the top. It's crazy over the top,
but very believable.
Yeah, like it's all there. Everyone's on point, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, I think that's Holly Hunter's natural accent, only just super emphasized.
Right.
Yeah. And so you have, like, what's amazing about her performance is that in any other hands, she would be really annoying. Like, she would be
I fell in love with her.
But she is
so
likable in broadcast news.
Broadcast news.
Unbelievable.
I was in love with her. I was like, man, this girl is so smart and beautiful.
I don't think there's ever been an actor who is both so likable yet so like.
Sally Field.
Yeah, I would say that I like Sally Field, but she's better than Sally Field, right?
Yes, of course she is. But she was basically a smart Sally Field.
Yes, like, cause she's so up in her head all the time, right? But she never undersells the emotion. Like, because like you have characters like Lauren Hutton was really good at playing like the super up in her head characters like Network and stuff like that. Or Lauren Bacall. What's her name in Network? Anyway, like, you know, Dunaway. From Chinatown. Faye Dunaway. Thank you. Like Faye Dunaway is great at playing hyper intellectual characters that are dominated by their how much they overthink things. And Holly Hunter does that, but you also like them. And it's like, I don't know how she does that balancing act, because it's in every other actor, it's a trade-off.
Right.
And in this, like, she's so focused, like, I gotta have a baby, I gotta have a baby. But she that she doesn't treat High very well. But no, she's a pushy she kid, is yeah. always coming from this loving place anyway
well,
that makes
I
me
want
like
this
her.
Family, and we're going to be a family. And yeah. he's generally okay with it because he will pretty much do anything.
Like, he loves her. Like, he absolutely loves her. Yes, absolutely loves her.
And he looks at this as like, okay, my life has changed, and now I'm going to be the good person, even though I have no idea what that actually means.
This is it's a perfect way to describe it, because like he loves her so much, and he is terrified that he is not a good enough man to live up to her standard, right. You know, and it makes him really likable. It makes her really lovable. And as crazy as their plan is, it's like,
he's like, I'm going to be the good person. And apparently the good person to her is to steal a baby.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's lost her fucking mind. She's lost her mind, you know? And like when she's in the car, she's like the whole plan, like, let's go steal a baby. They got more than they can handle.
I love the fact that they show her in depressions. Like,
yeah,
she lost.
It's just totally just like the house looks like shit.
The house is like, she lost any interest in policing and doing housework.
Yeah, it's incredible. And it sums up so perfectly.
You never really find out how she quit her job. It's not pronounced at all.
Right.
No, they just said she just gave up the force.
Yeah. Like, yeah, she's lost all hope. And like, everyone has felt like how Holly Hunter looks in that one shot where she's sitting on the edge of the bed and everything just looks like hell. And she's like, you know, and so like, you're totally on their side as they go in, and he goes to steal the baby. Right, which is a hilarious scene just in its own right of like just trying to pick a baby and steal it is like, this shouldn't be funny, but it's unbelievably funny.
It's very funny. But it was I was thinking about that shot because I was looking at the whole thing. I'm saying, so beautiful. But that shot where they decide, okay, we're going to steal the baby, and it's shot from outside and it's dusk, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's grainy as hell. It's actually a really grainy shot.
Oh, they're pushing the film super hard.
Super hard, right? Yeah, to get in there. And they're like, let's see. And it like doesn't really look right. And like, okay. And then he gets in the car, but then they turn the camera around to the sunset and is like, it's perfectly exposed for that sunset.
Yeah, exactly. And that's when the titles
come
behind
in.
The camera.
The camera, like,
you know?
And they go, we should talk about the music. Soundtrack. The music.
Carter Burrell?
Yeah, it's Carter Burwell, yeah.
Is playing the entire time throughout the whole film. And
banjo and yodeling.
Banjo and yodeling the whole time, unless they're in a convenience store where they play the exact same music, but as Muzak.
Yeah, it's a long goodbye gag.
Yes.
It's like it's so perfectly done. And like Carter Burwell has been doing music, I think he's done all
the whole
of their
time.
Films. Yeah. And he's just a genius. He's an underappreciated genius. But this is such a, most of his stuff is very subtle and very, very.
Oh, this is not subtle.
This is the opposite. Like,
this is good and the bad and the ugly, like in your face.
Yeah. It's
music is playing the entire time.
And down, 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 down. Oh my god, it's an insane choice.
Like, yeah, like, what? That's the music you're going to play the whole time?
I can, for two hours. That these guys are so on fire as filmmakers that they're just like, you know what we need in this movie? Yodeling.
That's basically how they
do it. Yodeling's going to do it. And it does. It ties the entire movie together perfectly. It's incredible. It's totally incredible. And anybody who sees this movie, even the first time, you're going to step away from it humming this theme song in your
for the
head.
Rest of your life.
Yeah, it's just fucking hysterical. It's incredible. Yeah. So yeah, steals the baby, right? And the baby becomes
the way they steal the baby scene is just pure slapstick comedy, like Buster Keaton level crazy.
The babies become like this, like the way they treat the babies in this movie are like, they don't just let the baby be a baby. Like it becomes like a,
there's eight of them, by the way. In the credits.
Yeah, it's like a zillion babies. I know. It's like he becomes overwhelmed with the number of babies and it becomes like a monster movie.
I just think about
babies.
Like how people always say it's so hard to shoot babies. It's like they, cause there's so many baby shots in this film and the babies are almost always smiling
and they're and being held by the actors in scenes.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
So these babies, like, imagine, like, having a baby that's, how, I was like, oh, this one's crying. Pass me the new one.
And, like, and for, like, when you're around, like, when you're around a lot of babies, they, like, you have to, if you're not, if you don't have your eyes.
Yeah, they
on
empathize
them,
with each other.
Yeah, they, like, they start, like, crying. It's like they're in cahoots. <you know>? So this is what happens in this scene. It's like, they're in their own little baby world of exploring and, like, doing all this. And he's like, he is already in his nightmare. He's like, fuck, like this is what I was worried about.
Oh,
like,
yeah. Like I would, I don't know if I want to be a dad, and here I am trying to pick a bit, like picking a dog from the pound.
Yeah,
you know,
oh
like
my
it was
God.
And yeah. And the crib, what I love about the crib is like it's this big crib, right? And there's five names against the back of the crib for the five babies.
Yeah. Larry, Barry,
Larry, Barry,
Harry, whatever it is,
Nathan Jr., so whatever
Nathan
it is.
Jr.
And
Junior.
And who knows which one's which? Because they're all crawling all over each other.
Who knows? I think I got the best one. But he initially gives up and goes back down. So I couldn't do it. They were all over me.
Yeah, it was horrible.
You get back there. Was,
yeah. When he, and I when she rolls him out up the window on him, like, get the fuck back in that room.
They have more than they can handle.
They got more than I can handle. Honey. Like having to go back into the baby scenario is a nightmare for him, and like there's tension from the parents are going to discover him, and it's like it's so ridiculous that it's a heist film with babies with a baby.
And then there's all these baby cam perspectives, like the baby's under the bed, his face under the bed, the baby's crawling over the crib.
I know, they have like the Jaws cues playing, like
Jaws cues playing as he's doing that. Baby's going about to fall over the stairs. He rescues it at the last second.
They do not miss a beat, man. That thing is like just that one scene is that like you would make an entire movie out of just this. And this is just a
but
scene.
It's real slapstick. Like that's the like, and there's a lot of those moments of the slapstick stuff that happens, but this one is just like,
yeah,
just trying to like trying if, to if you've ever held like dealt with a baby and you're like trying to change his diaper and like, don't cry.
Yeah, and they're cutting downstairs to Nathan Arizona and his wife, and like he's like they introduce Nathan Arizona so well, like when he's just like yelling at the guy on the phone, just like two chairs you got. That was a
$500 tables. No shit. That's like
they introduced by an ad though, which is a classic,
which is terrific,
kind of like
right?
Dan
you know who he is. But two was it with a table and two chairs? You got a dinette set. Two chairs. You got dick. like he's in control. This dude is in control of his whole life. Like his wife is just like yes dearing the whole time. He's running his household. He's used
and
to
she
having.
She's
oh older. Yeah, like yeah, exactly, exactly.
He's white and old.
She's old, right? Like she's not. Yeah. Like, she's not young looking
like,
at all.
Like so, clearly, there's a lot of like hormone therapy going on. That's why they have five kids, right? You know, like multiple pregnancy. Like he's probably spent a lot of money to make this happen.
And she's about it. Like she might as well be a matron. You know, like her,
yes,
like her,
yes.
Like, it's so, like way up to here.
And
very
so, like,
unsexy.
the beauty of Nathan Arizona as a character is that he shares, and they point this out as the movie goes on, like he is a form of HI. He's a responsible version of HI.
Yeah.
Right?
You could tell because he didn't care about – it's not like he doesn't care about the kids, but he just tries to make the wife happy. He's
the same person.
You realize that when he catches them returning the baby.
Yes, exactly. And you're like –
that's
the
whole
guy.
He advises him. He's the dad. He's the father who tells him what to do.
Right. Exactly.
Yes, but he is basically HR, but just
he's a form of HR, right? I mean, like he's like he essentially when he goes to give the babies back, like it's just like he's saying like I love her so I would do anything for that woman at all. Like that's what he says to HI, and it's true for HI. So he's understanding, and he is equally as overwhelmed by babies. Like he's just like,
do you think because there's no consequences in the film that it's this kind of tale needed to have an ending like that?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that like, the real threat of the movie isn't incarceration. It's
or the violence or the shooting.
Or violence or any of that. It's would do H.I. and Ed stay together? And which is an open question in the end of the movie, right? And like that's the like it, that like that's the sort of sweetness of the movie is like you see how much they love each other, but this incredible stress might break them. Like the fear is real. Like it's
I think
very
the reason
real.
Why it was probably I was upon reevaluation of the film. I basically feel because they probably did it for budgetary reasons, they don't show their face aged at the end.
Oh, yeah. That's true.
But I think that was also a way to say this is just a dream. They never really ended up together.
Yeah, I think that's like, it's certainly like that they leave it as high as fantasy is nice.
Yeah, it's basically the ending of King of Comedy.
Yeah. Right,
Rupert Patkin, ladies and gentlemen. And
but like it shows that this may not happen for High, but now High can imagine it happening is him growing up. Yeah. Like I think you're probably right. Like I don't think that Holly Hunter and he stay together. I don't think that's in the cards. But like it's possible, and that it's possible makes you hopeful for High. And you know that he's going to go on to have something like this in his life now, you know, and so like
with it's somebody else,
probably with somebody else. But you can still go. Maybe they work it out. Maybe they get together. But
doesn't
that's not important. Like what's important is
it matters
H.I.
to me, Chris.
Like
doesn't matter.
But like it's good that they keep the threat active even in the end because like it doesn't. Undersell the actual stress of having kids. Like, you know, like that can fuck up your relationship. It can break your marriage.
Well,
and stress people out to
I have a theory about
extent.
Why Holly Hunter, like, she left High because she didn't like the person she became.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
And so she feels that it's because of High that she did it. But it was 100% her responsibility that she did that.
Yeah,
she is the one who committed all those crimes.
She also needs to grow up. Like she seems like the grown up, but she actually needs. She's in transition in her life as well.
Sure,
right. And so the people that they become in the end of the movie may not be people that end up together. That may be true, you know.
Right.
But if like you know, in that it's not the kind of like if you know, High goes to jail or someone gets killed, like then the threat is taken. Then it sort of removes the responsibility of what the movie is really about, which is like, this is a legitimate stressful change in people's lives that sometimes their relationships don't survive. You know, like you may end up staying married. Like there's plenty of people we know who stay married, but the that they had kids together changed them into people who don't like each other anymore. It became like a business, you know, like this happens all the time. And and I think it's an honest way to tell the story, to say like, you know, we're still making a movie about a real thing. Like the stress is for real, which makes the comedy better because it's not fake stress, it's real stress. And as long as you relate to it as a real stressor, the tension is high enough to make the comedy viable. And I think that that's where a lot of mainstream comedy today goes wrong is that
It's not funny.
It's not funny.
It's so important to have humor in a comedy.
They don't keep the stakes high. Like it's like you need to have like in order for things to be funny, they have to be stressful. And it's not enough to just tell jokes. Like you need like for a comedy to work, it needs to be a stressful story. Because like you're never going to laugh harder than when you laugh in relief or tension over something. And that's the mechanism of how the filmmaking works, on the filmmaking end of it works. And that's why these guys are geniuses at it. You know, like it's in Big Lebowski. Donnie has to die in Big Lebowski in order to validate the stakes in the movie. And everyone's like, I can't believe Donnie died. And even the movie says, I can't believe Donnie died. But if you don't kill Donnie, then the whole thing is just sort of like a fart in the wind. Like, it doesn't matter. Yeah. It has to matter.
Well, there's got to be... change, otherwise they're just going to do the same thing
Yeah, exactly. It has to be a legitimate change. That's what a fucking story is, right? And that's what most, and you know, not to rant about every fucking movie they make nowadays, but it's just like, if nothing changes, it's not a story.
No. But if you start off as a bad person, people may misinterpret it.
Yeah, God. Just like, what are you doing?
Or worse yet, if you start off as a good person and turn into a bad person, that's what.
That's unacceptable. Apart from being one of the most interesting stories you could tell, it's now unacceptable.
Right.
Oh man. Michael. This is why many movies, like, talk about a bunch of bitchy old guys, but it's just like that's why King of Comedy is both funny and really upsetting.
Yes, it is.
Like, you come out of that one going, ugh, that's fucking awful. Yeah.
Or Swingers.
Swingers, oh my God. But
tension. There's a lot of tension in Swingers.
The fucking phone call in Swingers might be the funniest scene in movie history.
Talk about tension.
Oh my God. Like, that's like, there's not one person on earth who doesn't understand the gripping shame of that scene.
Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be an answering machine. It's just you talking.
Just, you fucked it up and you're burying yourself now.
Just keep going. Just keep going down that hole. That hole is just so getting worse and worse and worse. Yeah.
Like, by the time he calls back that last time, you're like, don't. God.
That really was a stressful.
And then she says, like, and she gets on the phone and he goes, oh, hi. Don't ever call here again.
Never call me again. Like, that is Hitchcockian in its suspense, that fucking scene. It's unbelievable. Uh-huh. But yeah, so that's why I think that's why these guys are geniuses. It's just like, they know what the movie is about and they stick to it. The core of the movie is actually an important thing to them,
like, sure.
This is a real truthful thing to be making jokes about, and that's why it's funny, because you're relieving some stress in your actual life by watching the movie.
Right. So they commit the crime.
Mm-hmm.
They think that, or they're pretending that their life is normal.
Yep. Like, yeah, and they go through this whole big pretend thing.
Welcome home, son.
Getting ready to
pop. That's
the best, setting up the timer on the camera. And she's like, they're sitting there posing like they're happy. And Holly Hunter's just like, you're going to contribute to the management of the child. And he's like trying to stay smiling. We're sent to Bobby or Honey. Which is a perfect phrase. Like, he is talking about himself. Like, I'm about to explode with stress. We're sent to Bobby or Honey.
Are you kidding me? We got ourselves a family.
God, yeah, it's just incredible. And then, of course, you introduce the primary problem.
No. He has a nightmare first.
Yes, he has a nightmare.
That night, first, I have a dream. Right, because that's the big thing. These are the turning points.
Yeah.
That night, I had a dream. Right, and so that dream is the Lone Horseman of the Apocalypse is coming after him.
Shit's gonna come back and bite me in the ass in the form of this dude.
This dude. And this dude is on a motorcycle, and the camera is following him up and down these hills, traveling. Right. And this guy's got, you know, is mean and horrible, kills bunnies.
Yeah. And this is where your fairy tale analogy really comes in. Like, this is where it very much becomes a fairy tale.
Yes.
It's just like, this is the troll that is coming to kill me.
Yes. And you're following the motorcycle as it's going over the hill. Just incredible shots, incredible sound design. Boom, bada boom, bada boom. And then this camera just turns into a single camera that moves forward into a house, up to the stairs.
Yeah, up the stairs and into the screaming mother's mouth
of her son is gone, right?
Yeah, yeah. Unbelievable.
And then
I was reading, and I didn't know
the federal BI.
The federal BI.
I have to ask Richard, but I had heard that the guy that played him, Tex Cobb, is it?
Oh, yeah. Randall Tex Cobb.
Randall Tex Cobb, like, scared the shit out of the Coen brothers. And apparently he didn't know how to ride a motorcycle.
Oh, no shit. That's funny.
And so he broke his shoulder on the first day riding a motorcycle.
Yeah.
So they just gave – he's like, just give me painkillers. So that's why he was on painkillers apparently the whole time to do that, because he had to go to the hospital.
Oh God, that's awful. Oh yeah, yeah. Yeah, he looks like a guy who would be born riding a motorcycle. So
that's what they thought. They assumed that, and he scared them a lot.
I imagine.
That motorcycle had this effect on it where the lower pipes were the actual exhaust and the top pipes were just flames coming out.
And do you get is this essentially a symbol of HI's dad?
Yes.
That's what's going on, right?
He dreamt it to come into his life.
Yes.
And that was his
dad. This is the nightmare of who I really am on the inside. Like there's a bad man inside me. And that's the shared, Woody Woodpecker tattoo and all that stuff. Like this is what HI fears he truly is.
Tattoo on the guy says, "My mom hit me, my mom forgot me," something about his mom.
Yeah. Like that. Yeah. Yeah. So he's like, I will be a terrible father. And this is the reaper of terrible fatherhood coming his way.
And the reaper of terrible fatherhood.
Yeah, quote that. If you're going to quote anything from this episode, it's me not remembering that Raising Arizona takes place in Arizona.
That's right. Where did they film Raising Arizona? I believe it was Arizona.
I think it was in New Jersey.
Possibly New Jersey.
Was it Minnesota? Indiana? Yeah,
it sounds like the ending of the movie. I think it was Iowa or whatever he says.
It might have been Utah.
Yeah. But yeah, this establishes HI's dread is so supreme, and it's what motivates one of the top five comic performances in film history with Nicolas Cage. I don't think there's Gene Wilder in Young Frankenstein. Right. There's Cary Grant in Bringing Up Baby. H.I. McDonough. And then, I don't know. It's great for the last two.
What's his name?
Dustin Hoffman in Tootsie.
Dustin Hoffman. Yeah. What's his name
And Jeff Lebowski.
Jeff Lebowski. No. Who am I thinking of? I'm thinking of Western, Mel Brooks Western.
And Cleavon Little.
Blazing Saddles.
Yeah, I think that's it. In fact, I would put, if I had to choose, Cleavon Little would be in probably the top three. He's unbelievable in that movie.
Yeah.
And when I said Jeff Lebowski, I'm just like, Jeff, I mean, I think Bridges is perfect in that movie, but he's not the funny element of that movie. Jeff Bridges is not terribly funny in that movie. Everything around him is very funny. He's just confused.
Yeah.
But Nicolas Cage is a fucking comic supercell in this thing. Every single line he delivers, every the way that he stands,
even
the way he reacts.
Even his narrative is
It's perfect. It's literally perfect. Perfectly. Yeah. Like you said, the way his narration is written in this overly flowery language.
Oh. Yeah.
That is utterly different from his, who he is in his real life. But this is the poetic soul that he wishes to be.
And when he writes, but he can be, even
absolutely.
In reality,
when he writes
the letter to Ed. Yeah. However, if you notice the letter, it's written really sloppy. But the words are all there.
Yeah. Oh, it's so good. Yeah. It's so good. But even when he says honey and he goes, honey. It's a two-part word. Honey. Unfucking believable, this guy. There are many movies that I love him in, but there is nothing like his performance in this thing. This is just bronzable.
Bronzable. The bronzable performance of I think that there's something. He's underrated, definitely. Mm. We've always talked about this. Everyone's like, Nick Cage is over the top. I was like, exactly.
Yeah, he's like, I he's in plenty of bad movies that aren't worth the time. But I think that
Con Air was great.
Yeah, Con Air is great. He understands the assignment in Con Air.
Apparently, he improv too much that it pissed the brothers off.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah. In this film?
I suppose that makes sense. Yeah. He is delivering the goods.
We'll have
man.
To ask Richard, but real.
But yeah, he's like he's operating at full force in this movie in a way that normal actors never reach.
Yeah.
And so you have like, so he is, his stress is introduced in the form of monster on a bike, and the next day, or actually that night, birthed from the earth.
That was the funniest.
John Goodman and William Devane. John Goodman, who births himself out of the ground, which is just one of the most amazing.
And then pulls the other guy out of the ground by the feet.
And then births his brother. like pulling him up out of the ground.
And it's funny, I was looking at that, like how he pulls him out.
Yeah.
And I realized, like, how the hell did he do that? Because it's like, and I realized, like, there's the moment where he goes from leg to torso. They actually shot that in reverse because there's no way.
Oh, yeah. There's no way to do it.
That's insane. Yeah. But it was like, what the fuck? How did
it's
he
so
just
classic.
Do that? Yeah.
And then I love that, like, when they're cleaning themselves up in the, cleaning all in the bathroom. Off themselves in the bathroom. And in the bathroom, it has OPE.
Yes. Yeah. OP, that's from Dr. Strangelove. Dr. Strangelove. I was just talking about it. It was Dr. Strangelove. It's like, wait, OPEPOE.
I was like, wait a second.
There's a Dr. Strangelove reference in Raising Arizona as graffiti on the wall.
That's fucking gold, man. Pure gold.
Purity of essence.
Purity of essence. But like introducing these two characters is the first gasoline they dump on the fire here. And John Goodman is the other comic hero, as we've discussed in this movie.
So they So they just got home with their stolen baby, and these two guys show up in the middle of the night. and they busted out of jail, right? It's like, we felt that the institution didn't have anything left to offer us. Yeah, we left on our own reconnaissance.
Yeah. Oh my God. And Hunter instantly hates them. She's like, this is a threat to my child. You will be destroyed.
The whole point is that we started a family here. Yeah. We're a legitimate family.
This is legit. Now.
Even though I just kidnapped a child.
Yeah.
We are a family.
We can't have criminals in our lives. I mean, we are criminals.
They're literally.
It's funny. Devils. I watched this movie again, and it's literally, I feel like this is Storks when they steal that baby.
Oh, right. Yeah.
The animated film.
Yes.
I watched that. I was classic. Like, wait, this is Storks.
It's funny as hell, man. Yeah, like this is like this setup. Like once they enter the picture, because they're immediately like, okay, we're gonna tempt you with your old life, like come out and have beers with us, the boys, hang out with the boys.
You know that he gets tempted because when she's like, you know, depressed and they have a baby, and he says, I find myself driving by convenience stores.
That weren't on the way home.
They're not on the way home. That's like going by a bar, right? Yeah, or like a strip club or something. Like, I'm tempted to rob a convenience store. Like,
that's so good. That's the thing that he's jonesing for. And at the same time, when does it come in? When he wants to have this legitimate life, and his boss and his boss's wife come over. And like,
oh yeah, but well, that's the thing, right? So the two guys are there, conflict. She's like, I have a normal life with normal, decent
friends over.
Right. And she says, look, you guys got to make yourself scarce because he's like, we have some decent folk coming over tomorrow. Yeah. And it's like, I should be with them. I should, you know, hang out with the guys. And it's like, I guess maybe not. And his face of just complete shame.
And so, Goodman's looking at him like, oh, you're so whipped. Like, this is ridiculous. You're just going to do it.
Who wears pants around here?
Who wears pants around here, HI? Right. And these guys smell like they literally came in through a sewer main and
the
fucking house. Right.
Yeah.
But like, and the other one, they're eating breakfast the next morning.
We don't normally smell like this, Miss McDonough.
And Goodman says, the other William Devane goes, why don't you breastfeed him? Right? And you appear to be capable.
Mind your own business.
Why don't you just mind your own business? We're having some decent friends over.
You don't do it now. They're going to regret it later.
Yeah. It had an effect on us.
They go back to the doctor. Like, the doctor tells us in jail that in we jail, escaped.
Yeah. Oh, my God. So fucking good. And so, like, they make themselves scarce while the boss and his wife come over. And the boss and his wife
Who's the guy? The boss, he was in a bunch of things.
He is fucking hilarious.
Yeah,
the foreman, right?
Yeah, yeah. Oh my god, this dude. Hang on.
Not JT. Yeah, he was the foreman boss. Yeah, I've seen him a lot. So fucking funny. I gotta look him up.
His name is Sam McMurray, and Sam McMurray is just in a bunch of he's mainly in shitty movies, but he's the best Animal part House? Of shitty movies. Yeah. He is. Let's see. He is known for.
He's also in LA Story. LA
Story.
He was, I believe, in Anchorman too, right?
Yeah, he's in Anchorman. Yeah, LA Ken. He's still working today, still doing stuff. Oh my god, his IMDb is like a million miles long. Yeah, he starts in Kojak.
Wow.
Wow, man. That's wild. He's in Chud, so he's probably friends with Goodman already.
Yeah.
Moonlighting. Yeah. 21 Jump Street, Matlock, The Simpsons, fucking forever.
Everything.
Absolutely everything, this guy.
He is in a ton.
And so he shows up, he's one of the that guy kind of actors. But when he shows up in this, this is stone cold hilarious.
This is the nightmare that you have, right? Yeah, of your parenthood and what it's like to be a dad. The kids are absolute terrors.
Yeah, like he's got five kids, totally out of control, like writing on the walls, like fucking every just nightmare activity. And his wife is this overbearing, super intense.
This is a thing that, like, when I was, you know, before I got married or anything like that, there's a guy I knew in college, and his whole goal was to get married, buy a house in the suburbs, have the boat to go to the lake house. Like, that's life.
That's the goal, right?
That's the goal right there, right? The lake house, the regular house, the great lake house, the stable job, the 401k, the wife, the two kids, good school district.
Right.
the house with the frog, with the fourth room over garage, you know, like the frog house. Like all of this stuff in a cul-de-sac, that was the goal of their life.
Cul-de-sac, even like,
yeah, living in a cul-de-sac. Well, yep.
That's the dream, right?
Right.
And so, like,
it's the life of a poltergeist, right? Like that.
Yeah, exactly. The low end suburban settlement.
Right. And so this, which is funny, if you go back to look at Polka Dice, those guys are crazy with all their freaking crazy stuff. But in this movie, he's like, you want to be an adult? Here's all the shit that's going to go on. You're going to be a tons of responsibility. And even if you have that, your kids are going to be nightmares.
Yeah. Your life just, because High is looking at this like, oh my God. Like, this is who I will become. I won't even be a manager. I'm going to be under this guy.
Right.
And he's wearing his white shoes. My kids are going to be terrible. Yeah. It's just fucking awful. Like, the shoehorn. Oh my God. And this guy is just this bragging fucking moron. Like, it's just.
See, that reminds me.
Awful. Yeah, so that reminds me.
See, that reminds me.
He's just talking bullshit the whole time.
You hear the one about the Pollock trying to light bulb? What? No.
And H.I.'s just got to put up with it because this is foreman, you know? And so he's just like rambling off all this idiotic shit, right? And H.I.'s like, yeah, I guess so, Glenn. Like, he just has to keep on saying it.
Yeah.
And it gets worse and worse and worse until H.I. is trying to say, I need to express some stress. Like, it looks like.
Well, first of all, the other thing that's going on is while he's experiencing that, Holly Hunter is dealing with the mother
the
on
wife.
The other end,
yeah,
who
right.
is basically like throwing everything at her. Like, you haven't thought this all the way through.
Yeah,
all she has is the baby,
and it's so much more complicated. It's like she doesn't understand, but we got to do this.
You got to get the shots. You don't have a pediatrician. Have you started a bank account?
Oh, you got to do that.
Yeah,
you got to do that.
Oh my God, you got to do it this instant.
This guy, is you going to take him to Arizona State? You going to do that? You going to save for his college? You got to save for his orthodonture too. You know, like everything.
If you don't do that, you're like he's going to have a horrible life, and everything's going to fall apart.
Yeah.
And so like they're losing their minds with stress, and these guys are acting like they have it under control, and their kids are fucking terrible.
Yeah. But at the same time, Holly Hunter is like, oh shit, we gotta do this, gotta do this, gotta do this. And High is like, hold on.
Yeah, no.
He's in a daze, right? Yeah,
exactly. Like, and then the whole thing starts to slip, like, because the idiot boss is like, so how'd you get through your adoption so fast? Because like with me and Dot, we tried to do that because there's something wrong with my semen. He's just like going off.
But they have four kids. I don't know how.
Yeah, exactly. There's something wrong with my. And just like, what the fuck is going on with you? Right? And this dumbass just sort of figures out that this doesn't make any sense. Like he doesn't notice that he figures it out, right? Like the dummy is just sort of like, oh, it's weird that you happen to get this kid so quickly when I know adoption takes years,
right?
And like High's like, oh fuck, the jig's up, this is it, you know. But it doesn't even occur to the guy as he's saying it out loud that it makes no sense.
Right.
He's just sort of like prattling on, you know. And one of my favorite fucking lines in the entire movie or the exchanges.
Well, he keeps interrupting himself.
Yes. By saying, yeah.
That reminds me.
And when he says like, yeah, we tried to adopt, all I had was like a kid with a heart born on the outside.
How long does it take like up to 10 years to get a healthy white child? It's like
what
else you get? Else you get
like,
else you got? It's a black kid with a heart born on the outside.
Yeah,
that's and weird.
And then fucking High goes, it's a strange world. The guy goes, it's a strange world. He goes, yeah, they should sell tickets. I'd buy one. Like, what the fuck is happening? So like this is a classic bit for the Coens where it's just like someone just comes in and solves the fucking mystery without even thinking about it.
Right.
Like it's this obvious to this moron. Like,
that you stole the baby.
Oh shit. Like now it's like with all the other stress, this is now like High's like, we are going to be caught. Like this is bad.
Right.
And then the guy takes it one step further. He's like, I hear you're all stressed out, High, and I have the solution. Like,
have you heard of ménage à trois?
Have you? I would like, now I want to tell you, my wife thinks you're cute. Well, thanks very much, Glenn.
Thanks.
And I think that Holly Hunter's cute. He's like, get your damn hands off my wife. Starts talking about what he's like, what am I talking about? I'm talking about sex, boy. I'm talking about L'Amour. I'm talking about wife swapping. Punch. Decks the dude, his boss. And it's over. Now everything is fucking
now
over.
Now it's really bad.
Now it's really bad. Like when Glenn, the dumb boss, just immediately starts running away from High as fast as possible. He's just like, and he says, I pity you. And then runs headlong into a tree. It's one of the great moments in comedy history. But his life is now fucked. His life is absolutely fucked. And then the next scene, it's
but
even
he did
more
the right
fucked.
Thing.
Of course, and he even says so, Holly Hunter's just like, why'd you punch him? Now he's just going to fire you. He's just like, what do you got? What do we got now? He's like, a man for a husband. Like, he's like, I stood up for you, right?
That's true.
And, but little do they know that because the idiot figured it out, now John Goodman and his partner are like, this is a stolen baby, eh?
No, they find out when he comes back to say he's going to sue him.
Right. Yes, exactly. And so, like, once they find out because the dummy comes back, like, this is a stolen baby, that's when John Gooden's like, we can collect the reward on that baby.
But, yes, before they do that, though, they try to get High to get in on a bank heist with them.
Right.
So they get the bank heist going, so it's like, great. So you're not going to be part of the bank heist, so we're going to do both.
Yeah.
Hayseed Bank.
Hayseed Bank, right. So basically what they're going to do is there's a specific bank in this really small farmer's town, farming town, that normally doesn't have much money. But on this time, everyone, all the farmers come in to collect their checks.
They get it all at once from the government.
And so they get a ton of money in the bank so that they can pay out all these checks. And that's what the money they're going to steal.
Right. So, yeah, but yeah, this whole other big, beautiful crime happening in the Coen Brothers film. It's amazing.
Right.
And so they rope high into this. And now we can definitely say that this is the scene that most directly affected us as filmmakers.
Yes, you're talking about the car stuff, right?
I'm talking about the car stuff, the bank robbery, like everybody freezes, everybody down another, the ground.
Yeah, there's another car. There's another car scene that we didn't talk about. Nick Cage and Holly Hunter realize their life is shit, mm-hmm. right? And they can't. He's not going to have a job. They don't do anything, and he doesn't know what to do. He's just a man for a husband, and she's very upset at him. They got the baby in the back, and he's like, I got to do something. I'm going to stop. We need to get some diapers. Stops at the convenience store goes for it, right? Robs the convenience store, full blast, at which point now we have one of the greatest car chases.
Just the opening of this scene when he pulls the stocking over his head, and he's pointed the gun at the cashier.
That is the poster.
This is so good. He's pointing the gun at the cashier. Holly Hunter sees this, and she's like, you son of a bitch! And this is a perfectly framed comic gag, right? This is what we're talking about with Richard. It's like, you know, you have, and one side of the screen is the cashier. The other side of the screen is Nick Cage. Gun pointing at a cashier across the way. In the middle, out the window, Holly Hunter, very small in frame, is screaming, you son of a bitch! And getting into the driver's side of the car, he looks over and turns back to the guy and says, can we hurry it up? I'm in Dutch with the wife. the idea, the dude has a gun on the cashier and he's explaining that he's in trouble with his wife. Like, listen, I hope you can empathize.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Here you go. Like,
oh my God. Could you just hustle this up? Sorry about this.
There's something very strange about the kid that worked behind the counter eventually chases after him. It's almost like maybe it's like a Sam Raimi. There's something.
This is a very Sam Raimi scene. Absolutely.
Right? And the kid, the way he looked.
Yeah.
It's like this creepy kid. Another type of character for a movie.
Yeah. And then.
Well, he's supposed to be the pimple faced kid that's reading Jugs
Magazine. I know, but there's a demonic smile.
Oh, yeah. It's like, oh, action's going to happen.
A little Dennis the Menace kind of looked at him a little bit.
Strange. Yeah.
And it kicks
off. Like Mad Magazine.
Yes.
He looks like a Mort Drucker drawing.
I was going to say Archie, but
But like once that kicks off, this car chase is as good as anything in Ronin. It's radical. Like there's so much shit going on.
Yodeling and banjo playing the whole time.
you got car chase with cops, Doberman pinchers, fucking high running through houses. Like it's in and a bag of Huggies holding it all together. Right. Like you have to get the Huggies home no matter what. Keep the Huggies in play.
He's robbing the convenience store. He says, I'll take these Huggies and whatever you have in a cash register.
Yeah.
So the Huggies were the first thing he says, right? Yeah.
Right. And so like the entire chase revolving around this, the object of the diapers is a great example of like, this is the theme of the movie in a nutshell, in a single scene. Like the Huggies are the symbol of taking care of the baby. That's parenthood. Right?
Well, that's the, like, oh, that's, oh, remember, you got to get the Huggies.
Yeah.
Like, that's the responsibility.
This is the responsibility of being a parent. It's like, you must make sure you get the fucking Huggies. Like, that's it. Right. And we are criminals, you know, and our life is bananas.
Committed a crime with Huggies.
I committed a fucking, like, this is a symbol for being a parent. Like, your life is absolutely fucking insane, and it's all revolving around this thing, this one, this like we gotta get the Huggies. I don't give a shit what's happening. Yep. And to the point where when the car chase ends and he gets in the car with her, like they speed at the Huggies, which are in the street, and pick it up as they as they drive away.
Well, the other thing that's hilarious is when she picks him up, she's
punches
yelling
him
at him,
in the face.
Punches him in the face. He's apologizing to her. He's like, I'm going to fly straight from now on. I'm going to be, you were right. I was wrong. Blah, 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 blah. Oh, turn left here.
Turn left here.
Yeah, you do that.
Yeah. It's like trying to get the huggies.
Perfect marriage. It's a perfect marriage.
But it's hilarious.
Like, God damn it. It's yelling at each other. It's like, I'm going to start. Oh, and turn left here, honey. Okay. Like, oh my God. Yeah. It's just like, It's such a perfect encapsulation of a relationship, in that just this one fucking single sequence, like they're both at odds, you know, like they're passionately involved. They have a central thing they're trying to do. It's played as a comic heist. Like you just can't get better than this. Like that is like, it's like the movie is super high stakes, ridiculous nonsense. But if you strip away all the comedy, you're still going, yeah, basically, this is what raising kids is like. Yeah. Like, it's amazing. It's completely amazing.
Yep. So that's one of the car chases. That's one of the pinnacle ones. So I want to make sure we mention that, because that's different from the other ones. And there's more.
Yeah, absolutely. There's more. So much happens in this movie. But yeah, so they rob the bank, right? They go in for
there's a fight. So he realized, like, oh, the baby, we're going to take the baby. And we're going to steal the baby and steal the book, the parenting book. That's the user Dr. manual.
Spock. Spock. Yeah, right. The knowledge, the golden knowledge of how to raise a kid. Yeah.
Right. And then the fight between them in the inside of the trailer is
hilarious. Jesus. Yeah. And now I'm not sure how many fights in trailers there are in movies, but this is as good as the fight in the trailer in Kill Bill.
No, like, the other good one is A Lethal Weapon 2.
Oh, another good one. Yeah, okay, so there are three great fight sequences in mobile homes. And
we should have a mobile home film festival.
Oh, man, this is a good one. There's one.
What's the other one? True Romance is another. There's probably a good one.
Yeah, like these are really terrific.
But this one is
maximal use hilarious. Of
especially
here.
When you have the popcorn ceiling and the knuckles.
Oh, so good. And use the environment. It's like reaches up, smashes him, and goes, rakes his knuckles across the screen, the ceiling, starts screaming because it hurts so bad. Yeah, like they don't just let the environment be a passive background. Like an active character who's there to fuck you up.
What's really funny is they shoot it super wide and yet it still feels super confined.
Yeah, it's great.
His face, like, it's like right up on his face, like, you know.
Yeah, punching through walls and shit. Like, it's just
and
absolutely
Nick Cage's
awesome.
Face with a wide angle is very funny.
Yeah, comic gold. But yeah, so like you have stealing the baby, bank heist, and Unpainted Huff Hines. We have to keep up with that plot too.
You have to keep up with that. Right.
Unpainted Huff Hines' dad is like, he's involved with the FBI, right? And like,
they're trying to ask him a million questions. They're like, why are you guys all here in the one place we know he isn't at?
Where my boy ain't at? Oh my God. We're just like, what does he look like? He's a baby. He's got Jamie's on. He's got Yoda's and shit on it.
He's dressed in a three-piece suit. What do you think he was? Jammies.
Yeah. Sir, at this point, I think you'd like to wash your hands.
Like, $500 camel hair suit. Oh.
Oh my God. Yeah, so like that's the pressure coming down. You have the fucking assassin, whatever he is, biker guy.
Smalls. You got John Goodman, you've got the bad, you've got the pressures from all angles, right? And then you've got the foreman
possible, yes,
right?
Yeah, everything.
But I also love, like, immediately they steal the baby, like Goodman and the other one. And the baby is adorable and cute and giggling the whole time. So everyone loves the baby, right?
Yeah.
Two of them immediately fall in love with this baby.
And they become parents.
What is little brother?
Yeah.
I was saying earlier, storks.
Yes.
Is it storks? It's the whole movie is about these guys stealing a baby and then falling in love with it.
Yeah. Yeah. And they start like caring for the kid, even though they're kidnapping the kid to sell it for money. Like, they're just like,
he smiled at me.
I think he had a little accident.
Oh, that's just natural.
Oh, that's just natural, partner. That's like Goodman and Forsythe become like a married couple.
He steals the show, Goodman, on this. Oh, still God, to this day. Great. It's so good. You wait for every moment he's in. He's really great.
Well, they go to the convenience store. They get the Huggies too, right? And then they try to get, you know, they look ask for other things like how do they go on? And it's like, oh, I was like, I believe they go around the back. And it's like, I know how to go on. Do they get fasteners? It's like, I think it's all pretty self-explanatory. I was like,
yeah, so well, you got fasteners or tape bits. You know, like, and our favorite bit of dialogue from this whole sequence when he's just like William Forsythe picks up and it's like, oh, we can get a little some balloons for the kids, right?
Do you come in funny shapes?
Shapes. That's like you think round is funny.
Round is funny. Oh my God. Yeah. It's fucking endlessly incredible.
And then that's what's best about that is that's a hilarious line. And then they do it again when he goes back in the car. It's like, I got some balloons. It's like, are they coming in funny shapes? No, just circular.
Just circular. Just circular.
But you see, they did that in No Country for Old Men with a guy. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, which coin? They like to take
exactly the
convenience store guys and use them as this kind of
the foil for the bad guys. Yeah, it's hysterical. Yeah, I mean, the Coens definitely have like these. There are certain scenes that they love, like it's like the body by the side of the road scene. They do that in like three films. You know, like they just love reconstructing these elements like that.
The people driving by in Fargo.
Yeah.
And they see him carrying a dead cop.
Yeah. Oh, God. It's so good, man. So good. I had never thought about the No Country connection, but I think you're exactly right. It's basically the cashier scene, the cashier with the coin. Yeah. It's amazing.
What did I lose? Everything.
You've been pulling up your whole life. Oh, man. Yeah. Like, maybe I shouldn't talk about other film podcasts on this podcast, but I listened to this great podcast called The Rewatchables, right? And
aren't those the guys that said CG is bad?
Yeah, no, they're just sports guys. You know, like they don't know anything about the industry, but they love movies and they talk about the movies they love. And they have this great thing they do where they just sort of give out fake awards to whatever movie they love. And one of the awards they give out is the Waiters Award, right? And I guess Waiters is like he's a basketball player who's famous for, like, not a great basketball player, but incredible at 3-point shots. So you bring him in and get like, you know, 9 points in a row, like boom, 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 and just reverse the game. And so this is their award they give to the actor with the least amount of screen time and the most amount of effect. Like, you bring in John Goodman he just blows the fucking movie out of the water. And like with all the Coen stuff, like, there's always the one
anything
actor
with Christopher Walken.
Yeah, exactly. You bring in Christopher Walken, it just fucking explodes the movie with an incredible performance. But like, I think that like John Goodman is a master of that kind of thing. He does that in Llewyn Davis when he shows up in Llewyn Davis for like a single scene and is fucking incredible. Like, he's just perfect. You know, he also does it in what do you call it? Their musical about the South. What is that one? John Goodman plays the guy with the eye patch. I can't believe that slipped my mind. Famous.
Yes.
Great soundtrack. George Clooney.
George Clooney.
All right.
Why am I blanking on this?
I can't believe this is my 50-year-old.
With the cows, not the livestock.
Not the livestock. Exactly. But like he does it in there. Like, but Raising Arizona is unique in that almost every actor is that character. Like, every single person who shows up in this movie is their best comic performance of all time.
Right.
it's like the entire movie is built out of these bricks of perfect, just show up and kill it performances.
Oh, brother,
where art thou? Thank you. Yeah, like, and it's just fucking
both
unreal.
You guys are really having trouble tonight with your memory.
It's constant.
I'm usually the one with, it's like.
Yeah, boy. It's
I'm
just
like Joe Biden most days.
Once it turned 50, it was just like, at least three times a day. I'm just like, what's, you know, the movie with the spaceships?
Yeah.
Super famous. They made like a million of them. With Luke Skywalker.
The blonde guy hanging in I'm the like, cave.
And my brain's sending things like, it's just like, it'll be like, it'll send all the neighboring names. It'll be like Battle Beyond the Stars. It's like, no. Fucking Star Wars. Just say it. You know, like, it's unbelievable. But yes, this is the, this movie has, I think, a greater number of perfect single comic performances than any other movie. Every single character that shows up, even the grocery store guy, when he says, not Les Brown is funny, that's the top of that guy's career.
Yeah.
Like that actor, you're just like, you killed it. You never have to do anything else. You said the perfect line, the perfect way.
Jason and then said Stephen Root is another person that just comes in.
Oh, Stephen Root's another one. Yeah, just comes in and destroys and leaves. It's just incredible. Yeah. But yeah, this is basically an entire deck full of those cards. It's just incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. thank you, Jason. Okay, so yes, they decide to steal they robbed the convenience store too with the Huggies and the balloons, but they forgot the baby on the roof of the car.
The baby on the roof of the car. Oh my God. And their reaction when they realize they left the baby on the roof of the car.
They go crazy.
No!
Never leave a man behind. And then of course you have the baby that's still in his baby seat. Mm-hmm. In the middle of the road, right at the center of the divider.
Yeah,
the road.
And the baby's fine. Yeah, baby's like, indestructible. Yeah. Just hanging out.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know, like, where they got the babies for this film. Like, it's like when you, like, not to compare babies and dogs, but, like, trying to get a great performance out of an animal or a baby is nearly impossible.
Right.
And this is, like, this kid is as good as, like, the dog in The Thing, where you're like, how did they do this? Like perfect, flawless, A plus performance from.
Yeah, I think you answered it earlier. Though it's like they got like 1,600 little babies,
right?
Just rotated them around.
Right? Lots of footage. That's how you do that. But like the kid's got like he pulls the hoodie down over himself. And he's just like, oh my God, how can you not love this kid? It's insane.
I mean, I just don't know how you do that. You just go to the hospital and you just look at all these babies.
Yeah, like it's basically just seen that Raising Arizona, where you're like, which one do I take? Yeah, it's insane.
Yeah, they must have just, like, oh, they all kind of look the same. Because right. Look at the babies in the crib, they all look the same. Like, how did they find so many babies that look the same?
Well, just hiring a good casting director or,
yeah.
Oh, do you know for the Oscars next year, they're adding best casting?
No.
That's actually... Yeah.
Really?
Next year. Best casting, which I agree with. I think that's very good. Because, like, that's a.
It's better than best box office.
Yeah, that's fucking.
That's crazy. Isn't that dopey?
Yeah. That's like the most yesterday's news possible award. Like, who else is going to fucking win? The one who made the most money, right? That's how it goes.
Yeah. There's no wondering. I wonder who made more money.
Exactly.
Yep.
But they're adding that, and they're still talking about adding stunt people, which they probably should have added first. But they are finally adding some categories that make sense.
Stunt people.
Yep. Best stunt performance. Like that should have been since years, fucking 30, Hooper.
1960.
Yeah. But
it's the 60s at least.
At least. Good God, I can't. Like that's it's so embarrassing that like this. Like,
oh, it's just going to go to Tom Cruise for everything.
Yeah, like that's really.
Yeah, he performs his own stunts, and then he's like, oh, no.
Yeah, best CG goes to Tom Cruise.
Then actors are going to try to do their own stunts, and then they'll die. Like, let's get rid of this category. It's encouraging everybody. To...
Like the thing is, stunt actors should be as famous as anybody else in the movie. If you have a great stunt performer. Yeah. Like the dude who did The Fall in Sharky's Machine was one of the great.
Poor or tie or
yeah, like tag it's just or... the fucking crazy circus act stuff they would do.
What was the Burt Reynolds movie about stunt
Sharky's
people?
Machine?
Yeah, Sharky's Machine has the incredibly long fall in it. What's the other one? There's Hooper, which is about stunt people. There's like
Rats Hooper is on.
Yeah, and then then you get stuff like stunt driving and fucking Bullet, like the guy the guy who drove with McQueen in Bullet. It's just like the driving in that is just stunning. And like, yeah, it's just forgotten, underpaid, ridiculous. But yeah, casting is good. That's a nice step. It's better than adding like another sound editing category anyway.
It's the same guys. They got two nominations.
Yep, exactly.
Why are they doing that now? Is it just to feel like they get, it's all feel good, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, the Oscars are nonsense. What are you going to do? That's always been nonsense.
Yeah, it's different. It's different, but that's fine.
Oh, pardon me for 1 second. I'll be right back.
All right. What was the okay? So they're in the Never Leave a Man Behind. They catch the guy. They catch they get the baby, right?
Yeah.
And then they go to do the bank. But at the same time, Holly Hunter and Nick Cage are in the car, and they're going to go. Let's go get that baby. He's got all the shotguns. He's going to go get the baby. But she looks at him and she says, I don't think I can do this anymore.
Hmm.
Right. She says, even if we get the baby, even if we turn the baby, even if we got everything did right, this is the end for us. I did something wrong, which is kind of very sad. Right.
Yeah. But it's also her, like her cop instinct. In a way,
you think it's a cop instinct? I think it's more about her realizing how everything went so wrong, right? Like how she's not about her being a cop.
Well, if you're a cop, in some way you look at responsibility and everything in a different way, more than right, more definitely than HI, right? So yeah. She's just plagued with guilt and responsibility, and she scolded him for coming in. To going to prison for so long, like she was crying.
Right.
So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I could, I'm not right always. So I just saw her character as like the smart woman.
The smart, right? Well, she thinks she's the smartest person in the room, I think.
Well, you don't have to be super smart. It's just the most responsible.
Right.
And think of your cause of your actions where, he has never done anything like that. He just keeps doing stupid stuff again and again. Kind of a dopey. There's a lot of guys like that. All you have to do is turn on YouTube.
But he's doing it all for her. Everything he does is for her. And even if it's really, really dumb, he's doing it for her. He just doesn't know. Like he honors her.
There you go.
He does the convenience store. Like he does everything just for.
I mean, isn't that basically Bonnie and Clyde?
It is. Yeah, you're right.
True, right. Right. And only in this movie they say Ozzie and Harriet in place of Bonnie and Clyde, which is hysterical. It's right. Trying Ozzie and Harriet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we also do notice that what's his name? Smalls. What's his first name?
Smalls.
Richard Smalls. Something like that,
yeah.
He negotiates with, with Arizona.
That threatens.
You're making me cry here. I love that. He's like,
there's like this $25,000 reward on him. It's like $25,000 isn't enough. I'm going to find your kid one way or another, but you need to pay more than $25,000.
Oh, and like I love that he says... if you won't pay, then,
market pays.
The market bears. What the market will bear.
Right.
Yeah, it's so fantastic.
Yeah. And what has that guy been in? The Smalls. What else has he been in?
Randall Tex Cobb? Let's see.
He was in Once Upon a Time in the West, wasn't he?
I think so, yeah.
That's why The Fly.
Yeah, that's right. Let's see. It is.
Because he plays with The Fly in the beginning of Once Upon a Time in the West.
No, that's actually, what's his name? The wall-eyed actor from the 70s. He's terrific. I can't think of his name.
Okay. Well, that's an ode to that.
Absolutely. He has been in a ton of things, but, most notably, Dirty Dozen, Ace Ventura, The Golden Child, Fury. I believe he is dead. Let's see.
He was born in 1950. Doesn't say he died.
No, he's still around. I thought he had died for some reason. No, he's still around.
He's 6'3", 225 pounds.
Yeah, he's a big man. Big fella. Mm-hmm. Fletch.
Is it Fletch 2?
And Fletch lives. Yep.
Yeah. Fletch 2, he's the guy in the jail. It's like, bend over. Hello, Ben. Yeah. My name is Victor Hugo.
Hello. Hello, Ben. My name is Victor Hugo. Man, I wish that Fletch jokes got more recognition. I told a great ball bearings joke the other day and nobody got it. What are you going to do? It's all ball bearings these days.
Ball bearings
these days. Harry S. Truman. Harry S. Truman. The president? Yep. He dropped the big one. Dropped two big ones. yes. That's a movie we should cover here. Fletch is amazing.
Yeah.
Actually, I've been meaning to see, what's it called? Confess Fletch?
Fletch, right?
John Hamm as Fletch.
John Hamm as Fletch.
I read Confess Fletch a long time ago, and I liked it a lot. So, okay. And I like Hamm. I like Hamm.
Yeah, I'm okay-ish.
Just
with
Chevy
that.
Chase is just flawless. The first Fletch is a masterpiece.
You know, it's really strange. Last night I had you're talking about, you know, what was it? Truman? FDR.
Mm.
Last night, my father was over. My father's 92. And he's like, yeah, I spent some time with Eleanor Roosevelt. I was like, what? I said, are you kidding me? He's like, no, I was out of Penn and I was head of promotions for the radio station I was at. And they were having Eleanor Roosevelt was going to come in and talk to the host. But she came like 3-4 hours early and she's just standing around. I said, would you like to go to dinner? And she's like, sure. So these security guys, he said, didn't say anything. And he had like an hour and a half, 2 hour dinner with Eleanor Roosevelt, just talking about world events and everything. I was like, I never heard that story.
That's wild, dude.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah, man.
In Philadelphia.
That's crazy.
Yeah, I don't know if Eleanor Roosevelt. Yeah, like it's like I don't even think the people really. I don't even think the people would really recognize Nancy Reagan today, let alone Eleanor Roosevelt. But like this stuff is like
or what's her name Nixon?
Yeah, Pat Nixon. Right. Nixon. Like, why is it that I know? Why is it that I know these names? Here's a question for you. This is an old man question. So, like, when I was in my say 20s. Like, I knew all these names. I read lots of books that were written decades and decades before I was born. I saw movies decades and decades before I was born. That is not common for anyone today. And not even just young people. Like, I think we just stopped paying any attention to old stuff.
Yes and no. History. Yes and no, because, like, my kids are coming back from school. And, you know, I know my kids are smart kids, and it's fine, but they keep quoting parts of history that I forgot about.
That's great.
You know, they're like, oh yeah, this happened. I was like, oh yeah.
You have a sense of history and love for history. Pardon me, Chris, Dan, mm-hmm. You, because I have the same thing.
Yeah. 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 I mean, I feel like, and actually, to be the truth, like my daughter Kate is a super freak for history. She loves like, especially the, early American history is giant.
I used to, you know, when I was like 15, I used to paint stuff. My mom was like getting me jobs with these old heiresses in Greenwich.
Right.
And I would go and paint, you know, their garage door, you know.
Right.
And then they would invite me in for tea and we'd hang out and talk for 2 hours. But I still
get paid.
That
sounds so Mrs. Robinson.
Yes. Well, no, these women were super old. But they lived in these gorgeous homes. I mean, huge, on the water in Belhaven. And this one woman was like, I won't say her name, but she was so sweet. And I basically repainted her garage inside and out. Not a hard job, but I strung it out for a couple of weeks, you know, on the weekends and stuff. But she would have me in for tea. So somebody that works with her, for her, would say, oh, why don't you have tea? She's waiting. So I'd go to this big library overlooking Long Island Sound and this, you know, home that's like 50,000 square feet, built in 1905. And I would sit there with my shorts covered with paint and I would have tea with her. And she would be like, you know, to tell me stories, and she had photos. And it would be like, yeah, my father was, well, I lived in Paris as a young kid, I'd ask her. And it was like, oh, and she's like, you know, yeah, we lived in Winterhof because my father was the finance minister for Tsar Nicholas II. Mm-hmm. But then when the revolution
Good
came
Lord.
And all the maids were sewing Fabergé eggs in their dresses and had to leave by night.
Right.
But all those kids for Tsar Nicholas II were her childhood friends.
Right.
And
right.
talking to her about that. And then her sister married the guy that invented the Gatling gun or something like that.
Sure, right.
Because there were all these beautiful Russian girls in Paris and Geneva. But it was just like, what? It was just like, but I would be like, that's Tsar Nicholas II. Like, you knew, she's like, oh, yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, and like, that's amazing.
I knew somebody whose father was, you know, doing these jobs, like whose father was the head of one of the biggest companies in Germany in the 20s and 30s. And she would – her mother was Jewish too.
Right.
She would go to Hitler's house for Christmas parties.
Oh, jeez.
And he would give her gifts.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Is that freaking –
fucking crazy.
I would be like in my painting, you know, covered with like this off-white shell paint, you know, from Benjamin Moore, like in the summer. Like, what? Are you
–
and just like memory lane. Oh, I knew Josephine Baker in 1928. It's just like, oh – okay, tell me these stories. I had one like that in Pittsburgh. I didn't do work. She would just send a guy in a Rolls to pick me up in college. Hit my house. I lived with all these guys in this old house. And they'd be like, there's the dude outside with the hat, Eric.
Right, right.
And the door would open. It was to be like a silver shadow or something, silver cloud. And I'd be like, okay, let's go. And I would just go have lunch and talk.
That's wild, dude.
Crazy stories.
I love that stuff.
F. Scott in the 20s. F. Scott.
Yeah.
Scotty. It's just crazy. Like who has, but to me that opened up all these doors. I would read everything about all those people. And I was like, I can't believe, you know, you met Hitler or you lived in the city in Winterhof with Tsar Nicholas II. Cause they also had the same school cause they were all taught privately.
Right.
So they were all classmates and just in one part of Winterhof.
Yeah.
And then the revolution came and she never saw them again. They were all killed, but they got out in the middle of the night.
Yeah, that's crazy. Yeah, that's insane. But this is the kind of stuff like I love that stuff. Obviously, you're totally right. And I'm not pinning on any of this on like, oh, the youth today don't even. I'm just like everybody. Like it would be weird to have like if one in Fletch when, like I think it's like a ladybird joke, right?
Yes, right.
You know, like which is funny, right? And I'm just like. But today that would be like making a you know Nancy Reagan joke. I'm just like, who the fuck would know? Like you wouldn't even do that today. Like even for people our age.
I told you about my art history professor that was LBJ's daughter.
Mm, right.
Which he taught her at college in DC. Yep,
right.
In the 60s.
That's wild, dude.
It's right. So, and so it's always security guys in the art history room.
Right.
And it's just. I would be like, that's crazy. But I've met people, my travels and stuff, and who just, oh, yeah, I knew, you know, I used to work with this guy, and it was in the 80s, and I was working in an art gallery, and he worked for Lee Krasner, who was Pollock's wife.
Yeah, right.
I was like, that's crazy. That's history, dude.
Yeah. And I'm fascinated that like we're in a window of culture right now where it just doesn't reach back very far. Even that, again, this is not about like younger generations or anything. It's just for everybody. Like are we only really reference very, very immediate
That's
stuff right now. And I don't know why that is. Cause
I think we're starting to like we got tired of people constantly referencing things from the 80s. I think there's a anti nostalgia feeling like I'm done.
Maybe,
like, and that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Well, yeah, but
because I've been talking about this for a long time.
Like,
I'm tired of this.
Like I'm not asking for everyone to be making Casper Weinberger jokes, but I'm just like I would just like for people to know
but there's
who the
no
fuck
sense
that is.
Of history. There's
absolutely,
no sense of history.
Absolutely, and I agree that there should be a sense of history, but the problem is that there's a rebellion that sees like we need to make our own history. I think that people are ready to make their own history and ready to move on to the other place, which I'm excited about. I do believe that they need to learn from history. do that.
Yeah, like yeah, and like there's no soapbox here. I'm just like I think that art used to incorporate
progressive
art used to be like for instance progressive left-wing people used to not be hyper conservative control freaks, but that's not true anymore, right. So hey, whatever, I guess that's just how it is now. Next, I was watching a link go ahead.
You have to be open-minded.
Yes, you must be in this very, very specific way.
You
I am
gotta be. I was like, if you think outside of this, you're wrong. Yes.
Right.
It is
very, like, I was watching Lincoln the other day, which is a movie that I love more and more, bizarrely. I think that's like, okay. I was not like knocked out when
I gotta remember where we were on Arizona.
Yeah, we're coming back.
Finished with Lincoln.
But the Lincoln thing, I was just like, that, like, you in the middle of the movie, you start going like, oh, that's right, like the progressive liberal party used to be the Republicans.
Oh yeah.
And it absolutely, like, all the villains in the movie are Democrats because they're all a bunch of fucking super conservative racist fucks.
Yes.
Right.
And remember, like, the South used to be very Democratic and very conservative.
Used to be Democratic before Nixon's Southern Strategy, right?
Yes.
Now, does anybody, like, how many people our age would know off the top of their head what the Southern Strategy was? Like, that's
besides
what I mean.
Us?
It's just besides us. Like,
yeah, this is the thing.
And it's not important.
First of all, it's brilliant.
Oh, it's fucking evil, but brilliant. Yes. But I mean, like, it's brilliant. And the thing is, like, that's the kind of thing that used to, like, the reason why I like, cause I didn't go to college, right?
The Southern Strategy is that people don't, you know, it's like, I've been lied to. Like, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. And so, like, it was a brilliant piece of manipulation and incredible. Like, very,
we're
very
gonna care about a thing just to get the vote, or pretend to care about a thing just to get the vote.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And it works till today, right? Mm-hmm. But this is the thing. It's like, I didn't go to college in any meaningful way. I went to, like, 2 years of a community college. But I know all this stuff because I love art and movies and books, right? And just by reading popular novels, like, and watching movies, movies themselves contain references to other interesting works of art or bits of history. Like if you're watching even Parallax View, you're going to get a sense of a larger history that you can then be interested in.
Sure. Right?
But movies today don't contain very much of that. Books today don't contain very much of that. Like, they'll be about a very specific thing, for instance. And the thing is, I think there's plenty of interest because, like, Oppenheimer made $1 billion. Like, it's not that people aren't interested in things, you know, it's not like, oh, history's so boring. Like, fucking Oppenheimer went through the roof, and that's a big, dense, smart movie, about history. But, like, just as a casual thing in regular pop culture, we have narrowed our focus down to more or less the past couple of years. I think that's really interesting.
I think to some extent, yes, and some extent, no, because I do listen. I listen. I'm very blessed by the fact that my kids talk a lot.
Yeah, no,
to
they're
us.
Awesome. They're awesome.
Okay, so they
same
tell
here,
me
Mike,
everything that's going on,
fantastic.
And so they know I am enlightened by their
absolutely
what they talk about.
Yeah, and none of what I'm saying is, I'm not on the Bill Maher side of this. Like,
No, I'm not saying you are, but I'm just saying, like, I hear things because from social media or the news or those kids today kind of conversations is at odds with what I'm observing within. Now, granted, my own kids. I know these are not represents every kid, but my own kids.
But it's good to know that, like, they're as in the know as you are at the same age. Right.
Yeah, but there's a different. Like, actually, they're way better. Like, they're way. Sure. My daughter at 18 is way smaller.
Yeah, smarter
than I was at 18. Way smarter.
Yeah. Well, I was
way heads up on
flat out dumbass at 18. So yes,
because do you know why? Because she has to be. There's no other choice. 100%.
100%. Yeah. So this is what I mean. So, like, there's no. I don't have any. There's no, like, you know. Oh, Gen Z is blah blah. Like, I don't have any feelings like that. I'm very, very pro on all of this. Like, and in fact, you're going to see much, as I always say, you're going to see much more interesting, richer experiences and depth of story and character in video games today than you will in any popular film, like, by a million miles. But just in terms of, like, the kinds of references that even Raising Arizona makes, like just tend, and this is, so I'm just saying popular art, not like smart guy stuff or I know a lot about history or any of that stuff, but just popular art seem to be wider reaching than what we, like if I go to see a superhero, if I go to see Black Widow, like there's no other leads to pursue in Black Widow. Like Black Widow is about itself and that's it.
Right.
And,
there's a greater story being told in Raising Arizona.
Yes. Like you get, like there's a deeper, like there are just threads that I can follow all over the place in this thing.
That
lead me into other artwork.
I think that's going to come back. It's just, we're still on the tail end of all the Marvelness, right? I'm not blaming this. I'll give you another perfect example. And I put this, I actually got a lot of attention on social media when I put it out there. I said that like blaming the state of movies on the CG, on the fact there's too many remakes, monsters or superheroes or any of this is wrong. Because the fact is Godzilla Minus One, which is a movie we covered a couple episodes ago.
Terrific movie.
Right. 100% succeeded.
Yeah.
And it had all those things. It was a remake. There was monsters.
Yeah.
It was,
It checked all the boxes.
And why did it, and tons of CG, right?
Right.
Why did it succeed? Because it was a good story. And that story, by the way, has all the things that we just noted.
Very, very true. Absolutely right? true. And like so, that has a larger context than even very interesting. Exactly.
And that movie just came out.
Yeah.
I think people are going to look at movies like that and say, I'm going to learn.
Just the idea that the implicit story of the firebombing of Tokyo that is in that movie.
Yes.
Like just from the setting. They don't talk about any of it. It's just the setting. Like, and someone's going to see that and go, why the fuck is it everything burnt down like that? That's weird. Mm-hmm. Like, and they'll figure it out. And then you get a lead on something interesting to follow.
Or you look at Everything Everywhere All at Once and people said, I don't understand what this movie's about. It's like, I'll tell you what it's about. It's about how complicated and messy the relationship between a teenage daughter and a mother can be today.
100%.
That's 100%. All it's about. Yeah.
That's a great point. That's a great point.
You know, and that's a complicated thing to do when they wrapped around this movie. So there are good movies that are being done today. Yep. It's just that we can't see the forest for the trees. Let's just put it that way.
You're right. I think you're right.
I know. The intention was to move on to the movie, but I just wanted to quickly. I want to quickly pipe in.
Yes,
that,
please.
Yeah, I don't. I think it's just beyond the movies. I know we talk about movies. I think there is a deep sense of like a void of history, and I think that's what Dan possibly might be hitting on, and I agree with.
Yeah, I don't mean in a judgy way. I just mean it's
just history is seen as a different thing today than it was. Mm-hmm. So the curiosity of history and how it can affect and shape us now is not worried about. A classic example is this, and I know you guys are going to jump on this, but I, as an independent, see both sides. Mm-hmm. I watched that Tucker Carlson with Putin. I don't know if you guys watched it. It was like an hour or two. But he made him look like a schoolboy. But the point is, he spent a half an hour, and I listened to it when I was working, telling him about the history of Russia.
Right.
And it's like – and it sounded like he was lecturing him. I get it. But he was almost like – and I was like, why is he telling us the history of Russia to – what's his name? The interviewer, Tucker Carlson. But it's like – nobody talks like that. Here's the history, man. And he was like, almost like, shut up. Here, I'm telling you the history.
Sure.
So you have to get a better sense of what
the
context is. And I'm like, I thought that's brilliant because
I could totally see that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like people need to understand the historical aspects of things rather than just say, oh, that's right.
Just reacting to whatever it is. Yeah. I have endless trouble with Putin and his crew, but the reason why Putin exists, he's not out of the blue. Like he is the result of hundreds of years of history, right? And like in Russia in particular, like there's a profound inevitability to characters like this, where you're just like, fuck.
Oh my
God.
He was talking about all these characters from like the 17th century that sound like thugs like him.
Yes.
It was unbelievable. Yeah.
It's just endless. And so because it goes back to the czars and whatever, but I mean, that's this is the stuff where it's just like, when you look back at like how we make movies today, right? It's like I was talking about, like, and I've talked about it on the show, like my fascination with Spielberg's War of the Worlds, whether people like the movie, don't like the ending, but all that stuff. Like, there is no movie that captures how badly 9/11 fucked us up than that.
Yes. Like,
and it's entirely unconscious when you watch the movie. I mean, you're kind of aware of it. Like, the imagery is, oh, that's very 9/11. But, like, it's more like what is happening for the characters, the stresses they're under, and, like, the roots of why this happened are all there in the film in a very uncomfortable, very disturbing way. And that's why it's a horrifying movie. So it, like, that's what I mean. It's like that movie, if you were to watch that today and go, what is the context of this film? Like, when this came out, what did this mean? And why didn't people talk about it this way when clearly it is actually representative of this turning point in modern history? Like, that's the kind of discussion I would expect to be having around a movie, like, at some level with people. But it's actually extremely rare, you know? And that's the kind of stuff that I'm just like, that's why, I mean, obviously I love talking with you guys about it, but it's just a rare thing. And when it's weird to see movies like Raising Arizona or Fletch or any of that stuff where you see these things sort of casually noticed where you're like, oh, that's weird. You know, like, here's the economics of the Midwest as regards grain and government subsidies.
Mm-hmm.
Curious.
Chris, I know you want to get on, but I just want to pipe in one last thing.
No, I'm not stopping you.
I heard some sad news yesterday, Dan and Chris, mm-hmm. that, you know, my old neighborhood is Koreatown.
Yeah.
And Nancy was talking to some friends of ours in Koreatown. They are tearing down the Parallax building.
Oh, no. No. I lived two blocks from that thing.
My daughter's school was next door by MacArthur Park. They're tearing it down to put apartments.
It sucks. That thing, it's such a weird building. It's such a weird building. They should keep that
thing.
I was
like, that's, she's like, you're going to be really sad.
Oh,
I'm like,
that stinks.
She's like, they're tearing down the Parallax building. I'm like,
oh.
I have to go get
photos there and photos, more photos of the train so I can complete my Parallax experience before it's all gone and lost to history.
And send me one because they literally are going to tear it down, which that is sucks. Just so typical LA, yeah. Just to destroy history.
Oh, you know what? By the way, I just saw, I don't know if you guys have a movie. What's available?
I watch movies.
Like, there's a movie, it's one of my favorite, documentaries ever, is Los Angeles Plays Itself. Have you ever seen this? What a fucking, it's all about architecture, history of Los Angeles.
It's like, there was a book called The Glass or A City of Crystal or City of something. And it was just about that, how they destroy shit.
Fucking crazy, man. Bunker Hill, like wiping out Bunker Hill completely and rebuilding it with like, and all these movies that like movies are a snapshot of these, of this architectural history of like the history of and it's just gone. Just LA is just like, fuck it, gone.
Well, like, dude, what? I've quoted this before. I live close to Larchmont and Vine and Santa Monica.
Yeah, we lived in the same area.
Yeah, Yoshinoya, which is one of those crappy Japanese food places.
Yeah, I've been there many times.
They tore down Phil Spector's recording studio where the wall of sound was with the recording room to build that Yoshinoya.
Oh, Jesus.
That's where the Beatles recorded. It had an echo chamber in it that was one of the greatest in the world. Designed by, was it Les Paul? Somebody, it's just crazy.
That's nuts.
So they built this room with these like things jutting out, and that's where you put the amp and the mic. So it gets this echo that's really good. The largest in the world is at Capitol Records underneath.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the one Phil Spector built. And put it in this storefront building in the back, and they record it from the Bee Gees to the Shangri-Las, Be My Baby, everything.
Yeah, man.
And they're like, we're going to tear – I was like, why wouldn't the USC just buy it for their music department?
Yeah, no shit, man. No doubt.
No, we're going to tear it down and build a new Yoshinoya.
It's fucking crazy.
It's so crazy.
Really, I mean, like, God bless Yoshinoya, but there's the zillion of them. You build it anywhere.
But that's – they have no sense of history. So I think maybe that's a problem too.
Yep, I hear you. All right, so Raising Arizona. That was a great little aside. Very fun. There you go.
Where were we?
I had fun.
Yeah,
I know.
That was a good journey.
It was a good journey. I didn't interrupt anything. I didn't say it was great.
You were being mean.
God damn it, Chris! I saw the eyes. Yeah, no, that was lovely.
Well,
so
why I put myself off camera.
We so they
I peed. I had a steak salad. It was delicious.
it's so nice. They robbed the bank, and two of my favorite lines back to back.
Well, there's a couple of great pieces in the rob the bank. They're like, well, yeah. What? Yes. So they're going to rob the bank. Go ahead.
Rob the bank. They bust in and say, "Everybody freeze! Everybody down on the ground." Well, which is it, young feller? Should we freeze or get down on the ground? Because if I freeze, and then I'm just like, what the fuck is happening?
Should I freeze? I came down on the ground. If I'm on the ground, if I go to the ground, then I'll be in motion. Shit, where are all the tellers at?
We're down here where you told us to be, sir.
By the way, is that not Bottle Rocket?
It's Bottle Rocket 100%. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Like, oh my God, I love Bottle Rocket so much. But that is Bottle Rocket. What, like, that whole scene is just, that's where it's from.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why is there tape on your nose? Exactly.
They're holding the baby by, like, bringing them in.
I love that line. Exactly. He's like, or that guy comes by to give him hell, his brother or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, Bottle Rocket. Sorry.
Bottle Rocket. And he's like, who's that guy? Yeah. I mean, he's such a jerk. His outfit's kind of cool, the jumpsuit.
Kind of cool, but he says, what are you? You look like a little banana.
He's like, yeah, it's kind of cool.
You look like a little banana. Yeah, it's kind of cool. But anyway, so yeah, they rob the bank.
They have the baby in the bank.
The baby in the
car seat.
Oh, my God. Yeah, yeah.
As they take all the money, they put one of those
paint grenades in the bag.
I've had one of those explode on me.
But yes, oh, tell Jesus the story. I was hoping you'd tell the story. Good.
Yeah, but it was the gas one that exploded.
How did that happen to you? Were you robbing the bank?
No, this guy. I was before I lived in L.A., so it was 95, and I came out to L.A. and it was actually at a place where my wife eventually, my future wife, bought a store, coffee shop, and that's how I met her. But at the time, I just was there, and I was at a party. I hooked up with this girl, and then the next morning, I was like, let's just go and get coffee. So she took me to this bagel place next to Soup Plantation at San Vicente and Montana, next to a chemical bank or a Citibank. And we were there, and they put the chairs and stuff outside the bank just to make use of the patio, not just in front of the bagel store. And we were sitting there, and this guy comes out of the bank with a gun holding all these bags. And all of a sudden, the alarm goes off. And I was like, we both look at each other like, what? And the guy's probably 6 feet from me. And I get up like, hey, what's going on? And the pack exploded. And it exploded.
It's crazy.
It's called the guys from the chemical bank or whatever told me. It was like something pack, and it was pink, and it was tear gas.
Oh,
and
God,
I was down for the count. I had to go to St. John's in Santa Monica.
So yeah, tear gas exploded in your face?
Yeah.
Yeah, the guy had
a gun. He was right next to you with the bag, right?
Yes, and it started going boom, and the guy put it right up to my face as I walked up to him, and he just kept going.
Was there any paint in there too? Or yes,
it was all this pink tear gas stuff with residue. It was it totally took me out, dude. I can't tell you, like, my eyes, my lungs,
burning.
And then I went and I was like, I called Chemical Bank or Citibank, and I was like, I was on long discussions with people in the legal team. It's like, I'm you have to pay for my medical bills. And they resist, and finally they paid my medical bills.
Jesus Christ. Yikes. You think that'd be the first thing? They don't want, like...
You should have showed up like the guy in Raising Arizona with a band-aid on his leg. It's like, you're going to get a medical bill.
I suggest you pay it.
I was pissed off.
I don't blame you.
But it hurts.
I pity you.
It hurts. And they never got the guy.
Yeah. I guess sometimes
they got one guy.
Yeah, exactly.
They got me.
You, good Christ.
Yeah. Okay, so you've experienced that thing, but in this movie, it's hilarious because there's blue paint everywhere, which is pretty funny.
Goes off, detonates in the car.
Like, there's actually
freaking out, trying to wipe it off the windshield.
There's a Mr. Bean episode where he decides to paint a room. Have you seen this? Do you ever see this?
No.
One? He decides he wants to paint a room really quickly. And so he goes in a room and he tapes down everything that's not painted. Like everything has got things like that. And he has a big can of paint and like a firecracker. And he boom like this and he leaves. Done. But there was someone that tries to sneak something from the room, and then when he comes back to the room's all painted except there's like an outline of a guy against the wall.
Right, right. Classic, yeah. I'm so like my Mr. Bean knowledge, even though I love Rowan Atkinson, my Mr. Bean knowledge is limited simply because I was so mad that he stopped doing Blackadder in favor of Mr. Bean. Because Blackadder is one of the funniest fucking things
Blackadder
I've ever
is
seen
hilarious.
In my life.
I knew him way before Blackadder.
Yeah.
There was a show called Not the 9 o'clock News.
Oh,
I know that show.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And it
you
was
remember
hilarious.
That?
Hysterical. That's right. I forgot that.
Hilarious.
Yeah.
In fact, there's a bank skit in it that's really funny.
Yeah, he was
really funny. Funny to go in, and the guy goes into the bank and he's like, I want to
not the 9 o'clock news. That is memory lane.
Yeah. And the guy goes into the bank and he goes, I want to get my money. And he goes, oh, Mr. Robbins. Right. And so they go back there and he's like, yeah, I'm afraid we have some bad news, Mr. Robbins. Your money's gone. I'm like, what do you mean my money's gone? He's like, well, you know, we're just a small branch. You don't really have a safe. So we put all your money in a shoebox, and then everyone's got a different shoebox. And yesterday we were robbed, and they took your shoebox.
That's amazing.
And it's like, well, yeah, and I was like, wait, what? And they're like, it's like, so my entire life savings. It's like, yeah, I'm afraid that's gone. And he's like, this whole thing about the shoebox, and they're like, what? And he just starts, and then he starts to walk out, and it's in shock. He's like, Mr. Robbins. We're just kidding. It's like, oh my God, you had me really terrified. Yeah, that's okay. It's like, don't worry. Here's your shoebox.
Here's your shoebox.
That's funny.
The money's gone. Here's your shoebox.
All right. So, the whole thing explodes. Mr. Bean, sorry, the bank boom. And him just trying to scrub a little hole.
The windshield
as he's driving at full speed in the car.
Oh my God.
And they're yelling,
That happened to me I was driving on the highway and it was because of the weather, like rain and whatnot, like it instantly started fogging. And once like your windshield starts fogging,
you're screwed.
You're fucked. And I was like on 65 miles an hour. I'm like, and I felt like this is the Raising Arizona scene, only it's really not funny right now.
I did this thing, which was a bad idea. You never, ever, ever do that. But I was on a road trip with my buddy, and it was dark, dark highway in Texas, straight road, middle of the night, and just driving straight. And we would do something called submarining, which is
really bad. Yeah. Don't do that, kids.
Don't do that. You turn on the dome lights, turn off the headlights, and see how long you can go before you chicken out.
That's like Albert Brooks and Dan Aykroyd in the beginning of the Twilight Zone movie.
Yes. Don't do it. It's super dangerous.
Yeah, that's not the smart stuff, but I know that trick.
Yeah.
With friends of mine, we used to this thing called the Dead Man's
Jason
Hang.
Said he had a squeegee for the inside of the windshield, which is, a trick. However, the even scarier one is that when you go in and not only does it fog up, but it freezes too.
Oh, God. Yeah. Don't do these things. Okay. So.
So they said to take the money, and then HR goes like, you know, ballistic, tries to get the baby back, gets the baby back. Smalls is after him. Mm-hmm. It gets pretty hairy. And then he blows up. How does he kill Smalls? Go ahead.
Because Smalls has a grenade on his jacket.
Yeah,
it has all these grenades. Right,
Smalls is beating the shit out of High. Like,
right.
And one of the great shots in that movie is when High is trying to get away under the car.
Yeah. Getting dragged out.
And like, he looks like, HI in this scene looks like Wile E. Coyote after a bomb has gone off in his face.
Yeah.
Like, his hair is bananas. Like, he's got like grease smears on his
face. And on top of that, it's in Arizona, so it totally looks like
it's Roadrunner
totally
material.
Looks like Roadrunner material, right?
Absolutely. And the road and what is it? Woody Woodpecker's. So it has it, like, they know it is an absolute cartoon by the end.
Cartoon 100%.
Yeah.
And so he hates him, and he just squeezing him, and then he's like, he notices his tattoo. Remember that one? It's like, oh.
Yep, yeah, he's got the Woody Woodpecker tattoo.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh. Yeah. And then when Holly Hunter hits him with the, I can't remember how it goes. Holly Hunter hits him and knocks him apart. Mm-hmm. H.I. has a pin from a grenade, like, in his hand. Like, he's like, oh, and he looks at Smalls like, I'm sorry. And Smalls, like, Smalls is like, his, like, oh, trying shit, to find the good. And then and he explodes. It's like a fireworks explosion. It's just
but extreme.
Extreme. Absolutely blows apart.
Well, he's got tons of grenades. So it's one grenade. It's like a chain reaction of grenades.
Yeah. Everything goes off. And so go ahead.
Did you see there's a video I saw, it was a YouTube thing about, like, what would happen if someone pitched a baseball at 0.9.
Oh yeah, I saw your post. That's light. Great. Yeah, it's hysterical.
And it's basically great. How it would turn into a nuclear explosion,
just blow up the entire city.
It's like the entire city would be.
Most of the baseball would turn into energy, which would then vaporize the city.
Yeah, so, it was an amazing video. I was like,
yeah, like, huh. By the time the ball hits the batter, there is no ball left. There's just extremely plasma. Accelerated plasma.
Everyone, and then the stadium's gone. The nuclear explosion.
SKCD style stuff. Yeah, it was really.
It was such a funny video. Yeah. But yes, that's when he explodes, it almost felt like that. A boom.
100%. Total cartoon ending, right?
Yeah.
And so, everything, like, everything is solved by this HI and,
well, all the bad guys are gone, except they're still the bad guys. They still have to
redeem themselves. They are still the criminals who kidnapped the baby. Right?
So they still have to redeem themselves. So they return the baby. They go through the window.
Right.
Again.
And the dad shows
up, finds them.
Right. And has that one last touching conversation with him, which gives you hope that maybe they stay together, you know, like, cause he just
before,
like,
you do something stupid, like busting up.
Yeah.
Sleep on it for a night. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, that's their advice, because she basically tells him she's not going to be.
Yeah. Like, she dumps him more or less. And then they're like, well, just don't, you know, like, give it some thought, really.
Yeah.
You know,
it and takes a lot of work. Yeah.
Right. And this is what the emotion of the movie leaves you on is, like, that, you know, like, it is a lot. This is a lot of work, and it can fuck you up as a couple. And, you know, like, you have to really face these things and really be truthful with one another. And it expresses this in another dream that HI has, only now it's a good dream. Right.
It's a dream about family.
It's a dream about family. And, like, that in the future, you know, Nathan, what happens to Nathan Jr.?
Well, it's what happens to, first of all, it starts from the present, right? So what happened to John Goodman? What happened to,
they go back to prison.
What happened to the stupid, what's his name, who tells too many Polish jokes?
Yeah, exactly. Boss, like, he's still trying to tell stories to the cops.
Yeah, to the cops. The cops won't listen to him. Everyone, so he goes, and then he goes, what happens to Nathan Jr.? Nathan Jr. grows up, and then it's like, it gets
projects
foggier.
Further and further.
Further and further. Yeah.
And maybe, you know, like a kindly couple that watches his life as he grows up, becomes a football star and all this kind of stuff. And of course, it hints that it's Holly Hunter and Nicolas Cage.
Right.
And so, like, perhaps they go off and, you know, like, they moved to another state entirely. Like, yeah, maybe it's Arizona, or maybe it was Utah, and it snaps back to HI, like, and this is the movie. Like, you're still left in the moment with HI. You know, hopefully he has learned his lesson, but you can't be sure.
It's a fairy tale.
It is a fairy tale.
Right. Yes, and so they end with a very fairy tale ending.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Absolutely.
And that's the whole point.
Well earned.
And so, you know, who knows what's happening? The whole point of this, the point of all fairy tales, is a moral, right?
Yeah. It's to make you think a little bit.
That's and the moral is like everything is good, and but, you know, don't go stealing babies.
Face these challenges.
They do a lot of that. That's the Coen brothers. There's always that message, which is beyond the great filmmaking. You still leave this with this message. It's just great writing and storytelling.
Yeah, because like they understand what stories. All stories are moral statements, right? They're all moral puzzles, and. Right. And which you are meant to learn from. Like the reason why we have stories is because of they are information delivery devices. They teach you something, right? And sometimes they teach you something positive, and sometimes they teach you something like be careful, you know, be careful not to do this. But the reason why we react to them the way we do is because the heroes of stories learn or don't learn. And in when they don't learn, we learn. We go, oh, fuck, don't do that, right?
Yeah.
And so the Coen brothers are very, very good at like focusing on this is a moral dilemma with the highest possible stakes, you know, and this is true for all of their films, especially their best ones where it's really, really clear. And like the thing that I think of, and I talk about this with Anne all the time, is that their movie, A Serious Man, which I love, right? Like the best example of this is in A Serious Man, the central character is trying to avoid making any clear decisions, moral decisions in his life. He's like, he's trying to elide responsibilities, right? And he's like, I didn't do anything. I didn't like, I want to avoid the fury of God, you know, so I won't do anything, right? And all these moral puzzles keep on being heaped on him the whole time. And one of the primary ones is there's a kid who's getting an F in his class, right? And the kid's dad is giving him a bribe to give him a passing grade. And in the end, he's decided to take the money and change the grade for the kid. And he writes the grade. He looks at the F in the logbook and erases it and then writes in a C, right? And then he thinks about it and he's so pissed off that he has to do this. That he writes minus next to the C. He goes C minus. And the moment he writes the minus, he gets a phone call that he has cancer and his son is going to be killed by a tornado. it's like the moral judgment of the movie is so swift. It's just like, you're totally fucked. You almost learned and now you're totally fucked. And that's true for all of them. Like the dude in No Country for Old Men. He is judged so quickly for making a moral mistake. He gets killed off screen. Like, you know, like he's just like, oh, maybe I will cheat on
his body in a motel.
Yeah. You're fucked. You're off. You're off board. Yeah. That's it. Like in the Coen brothers universe, like there is, God is immediate in his judgment. And like what's his name in No Country is like, whoa, I got away from that creepy killer. And now I have a second to myself. Woman goes, hey, you want to come have a beer in my hotel room? And he's like, maybe dead.
Yeah, but what's interesting, too, is then when what's his name comes, the cop, and he's in the room and he comes to the hotel room after and the door is closed. Is he behind the door?
Yeah.
You know, the killer? But he has such a different moral compass that he's saved.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Right?
That's exactly
right.
Because
you know he's behind the door, but it doesn't seem plausible that he's behind the door, but you know he is.
Yeah, but that's a very fine point to make, Eric, and I really love it, is that it's not that he has a moral code that I agree with, but he has a moral code.
Yeah. Like, it's obviously it hasn't helped him because he feels defeated, but yet he still has that code.
Yes. Like that is the ultimate responsibility. It's like the Coens are constantly saying you must take responsibility,
but that is also
for your life
because they were raised were they raised devout Jews? So it's with the
I believe
Torah
relatively and... so. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Not, I don't know, but devout is, you know, that may be extreme, but they were definitely, and like what they report in A Serious Man is essentially from their childhood, right? So yeah, very, very intense, like, you know, Talmudic and Torah influence and all that kind of stuff, which is, you know, the Old Testament is extremely harsh in its judgments. Like, it's like, that's the fucking way it is. Nature will kill you. Don't eat pork. You know, like, that's how it goes. And, yeah. And you're absolutely right. It made its way into, that's why they're great storytellers.
You know, like, yeah, that is, the, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Like, knowing what you are saying and what the stakes of your story are, it's the most important thing as a filmmaker or anything. And if you don't stick to your stakes, then you're not doing it, then people are going to feel dissatisfied. They won't know why, but that's what's happening. That's a great point.
Chris, are you okay?
Yeah, I'm fine. I'm good. Okay, so as we're wrapping up, I want to sort of let people know a little bit. If you've gotten to this far in the podcast, congratulations.
You are an angel.
You're an mm-hmm. angel, and you get to hear a little bit more about what inspired this. Like I said, like we said, we were sort of inspired by the fact that Richard Kudo was someone we were working with, has been working on this podcast, who had worked on this film and was involved on the camera crew, and this film has some of the best camera work around. We are currently working with Richard Kudo. We are actually producing something right now, mm-hmm. A substantial thing. Probably the biggest thing I've ever made.
It's definitely the biggest thing I've ever made, for sure.
Behind the Green Door, yep. too. And yep. it is got music. It's got everything.
All yeah. three of us are very, very, very involved. This is the first time we're really sort of getting something Martini Giant done. We've obviously worked on bigger films, but in much yeah. smaller roles.
For other people.
For other people. This is right. the first time where we go on set, there's a whole group of people involved, and they're looking at me, and I'm signing checks. Like, it
yeah,
was,
it's a real thing. It's a real thing that we're responsible for. This is it.
Real
yeah, exactly.
thing. And yep. so it's kind of an amazing thing yeah. to sort of be feeling. In that position. Terrifying. Mm-hmm. Talk about terrifying responsibility. Talk about me feeling like high when yeah. like, you had that burning sensation. Yeah.
Feeling yeah. like there's some big bear now.
Yeah, I keep telling her to lose some weight.
She don't want to listen. Oh my God.
Yeah, that's kind of how it feels, but it's kind of awesome at the same time. One thing that's been great is that we've all sort of taken the, you know, our the things that we do and sort of made this, each contributed in our own way to this project mm-hmm. in a really great way to compliment each other. So I've been very excited about it. It is hilarious. When this thing gets pulled off, I really hope that it comes off as being a big deal when this comes
yeah.
out.
Yeah. No, it's been extremely fun. I look forward to more fun. It's very intense. It's a lot of hard work.
This is very intense. This is also using very new technology that I've been doing, like Vlado, who's been involved in this, very mm-hmm. involved in this. And being with Vlado and, you know, a bunch of people in the Innovation Lab, which is my day job, and pulling this off is incredible. So just this is an execute. This is sort of, this is us putting our money where our mouth is, right? In so many ways.
Yeah, well, let's say like we've long talked about
both
like
creatively the, and to and technology wise, like everything.
Yeah, absolutely. Like the you know, they're the filmmakers that we love are ones that, you know, like not that any of us are François Truffaut, but François Truffaut used to just criticize films. Like, he used to just write for Cahiers du Cinéma, mm-hmm. and then people were like, well, you talk big about movies, you know, can you actually make a movie? And then he made the 400 Blows. So we're not saying this is the 400 Blows.
No.
However, we admire that mentality. Yes. Like
Ace Ventura, like, more like that. But
yeah, probably closer to Ace Ventura. Like, that's much more reasonable. But yeah, it feels good to, like, we want to express our love for movies in every way we can.
Yeah.
Both in talking
and
about
both them how what they mean and how they're created and everything yep. about that. So it's really kind of fun to do that and to be involved. And honestly speaking, there's been a support crew that's been put
incredible.
Around us that is yeah. unbelievable. Debbie has been an amazing person to make sure shit gets done. Like, I would never have thought of all these things, and she's just making sure.
Oh, for sure. I mean, like, in movie making itself is, like, everyone, like, you know, like, it is, it's the biggest team sport around.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't get talked about that way, but that's what it is. Like, yeah. And everyone playing at the top of their game is why things work out.
Yeah.
And it's really, really great to see.
It's going to be really fun. And like I said, it's like, we're going to talk more about it as we go, but just, you know, it's like, we're in the thick of it. I mean, like, every day,
yeah,
several hours a day.
Yep.
Most of my day is spent trying to get this thing done, almost every day, 7 days a week.
Yep.
It's a challenge, and it's a kind of a wonderful thing.
And this is not a 2-hour movie production. This
is a
smaller scale, but this is certainly
high production value. Short.
Yeah. This is trying to move in the direction of doing things like that. And
let's kick the tires on things and see how it works. Yeah. And this is in a lot of ways, but this is really what it is, but it's like really great. And this is, I don't know how we landed with someone like Richard as our DP.
Spectacular.
He's such a team player on this too.
we can confirm that, like, we've had the luck of working with some extremely notable folks in our lives in the film industry. And Richard continues the track record that I believe that, like, the best people in the business also tend to be the nicest pros you've ever met. And there's lots of caricatures of how people are in the movie industry.
Yeah.
But when you really work with someone who knows what the hell they're doing, like, they are both really together and they're really interested, creative, good people. Richard is a stone cold example.
When we first met him through Debbie, and it was on the Zoom call, and he was like, yeah, he's just talking to us. And it's like, yeah, I get it. It's like, it's cool. I understand what you guys are trying to do, and et cetera. And we start to do our little martini giant talk, and we ended up talking about Gordon Willis. Like, oh yeah, he's like, oh, I shot with Gordon Willis a whole bunch. And like, yeah, he's like, we're just crazy. Like, our eyes went,
yeah.
Like, wait, what? He's like, yeah.
And then starstruck.
Then suddenly he's like, yeah, I worked on Broadway, Donny Rose. And at which point Eric about just fell off his chair. It was awesome.
Yeah. Really, really amazing. And he's like, the stuff we've done so far, the stuff he's shot is stunning.
Yeah.
Everything's amazing. Great, great work. So it's exciting.
And we were on set and we were talking about Raising Arizona, and then he's like, yeah, I was a focus puller on that. I did all kinds of camera. It's like, wait, what? Like,
I just like just standing and talking with him. Like, he had just watched like The Friends of Eddie Coyle. And so we're talking about The Friends of Eddie Coyle. And I was just like, this is the kind of film set experience.
He loves film. And it's very interesting. He kind of fell into filmmaking, which is interesting. He didn't sort of like say, I want to be a filmmaker, went to film school. No, no, no.
Right. Right.
Yeah, so he fell into it.
He's just a pro, man. He's just a pro.
And he's been part of the ASC for a long time. And but yeah, it's kind of nice to sort of think about that kind of camera work and what's what we're embracing. So that's what inspired this episode.
Yeah, you guys will hear more about it as it goes.
I'm sure you guys are going to hear about it for years, because we will talk about it for a long time. But
yeah, it's been incredible fun,
especially if it goes well. Which we're still in the middle of it.
Yep. lot left to do. So yeah.
Oof. We'll see how it is. And I'm like, right now I'm still sweating it, because there's still some locations that we need to get nailed down, and I don't know. And people are like, okay, so we're shooting in April. I'm like,
Yep. It's the throw the ball as far as you can and run to go and catch it at the same time.
Exactly.
It's pretty insane.
So it's been amazing. So I'm hopefully we'll get this all figured out, and you'll learn more about it. But this is it. This is us doing Martini Giant. Is going to try to become is evolving as a creative entity well. So, which is cool. Yeah. All right, guys, you guys ready to do this?
Let's do it.
Good.
All right. Drink.
Talk.
Drink.